I'm opening the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, December 14th, 2010. We have several things on the agenda this morning, and they will be done in sections. The first will be a section on proposed legislative concepts. Then we'll have a discussion about home foreclosure issues. Then an update on tenants in foreclosure issues, an update on the homeowner stabilization program, and finally an update on work groups that the committee has been involved in. We're going to start first with the proposed legislative concepts, and I'm going to ask John Van Landingham, and I think Chuck Carpenter is coming up with you, to talk about the Manufactured Housing Coalition bill, and then John will be talking about the Landlord-Tenant Coalition bill, and these are going to be committee bills, and John and Chuck will give just a brief summary of those bills for the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Rod, John Van Landingham from Lane County Legal Aid. It's good to be back, I think. So the Manufactured Housing Coalition has been in existence since the mid-1990s. It represents landlords and tenants, park owners and park residents, and people interested in those tenancies. We've produced a bill, or a recommended bill, for the legislature in every session since 1997, and we are hoping to do the same for the 2011 session. I've given you a written summary of what might be in that bill. We've met 18 times since November of 2009. Working primarily on three very complicated and sometimes contentious issues that are important to both sides. Senator Bonamici has participated in some of those meetings, so she knows the issues as well as anyone. But the three big issues that we're working on, that we've hoped to have in this bill, have to do with submetering of water, which you've heard about before, something called subdivision conversion. And what that refers to is the fact that in 1999, the legislature amended the law to allow manufactured home park owners to convert to a subdivision, even though they might not comply with existing city subdivision standards. That did not go through the coalition. It went otherwise. And what we're trying to do in this bill is address a number of issues that were never addressed when that was created, particularly with regard to what happens to the tenants in that park once it gets converted to a subdivision. With a subdivision, the park owner strategy is to sell the lots to someone who owns a manufactured home and will both own both the home and the lot, which is great, but what happens to the tenants who don't buy those lots? So that's what we're hoping to address in this bill. The third issue that we're still working on, we have concluded negotiations on the first two issues, the submetering and the subdivision conversion issue. The third issue has to do with what we are referring to as opportunity to purchase. There are existing laws that that regulate the tenant's ability to compete to buy the park. Both sides agree those laws don't work very well, and we're hoping to clean those up. And Chuck is here to shake his head and say yes. we hope to reach agreement. Do you want to say that for yourself?
Yeah. Do you have anything to add,
Chuck? Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Chuck Carpenter, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, Executive Director. We generally, I think, have agreement on the first two issues that John mentioned, the water submetering piece and the conversion piece. I think we've done a good job in the coalition, and I think we've come to like minds. We appreciate the work that you've done on the water submetering piece, Senator, particularly the fact that it's very clear now that we have a primacy agreement with the Oregon Safe Drinking Water Program. Submetering is something that can be done in manufactured home communities, which until last year when you sponsored your bill, that was something that was in question. So we're very happy that that is very clear, and even though the proposed legislation does not require water submetering for communities of 200 spaces or less, for reasons that we've discussed over the last 18 meetings of the coalition, we will do our best to encourage water submetering in manufactured home communities from here forward, and I think we've come up with a plan to be able to encourage that. So we appreciate your work on that. And the conversion piece, we're very pleased with that. We know that Representative Clem had some issues with that, and we were able to clean that language up. John calls it an opportunity to purchase, and we call it a right of first refusal. So we are concerned about the third piece of the coalition, which has to do with when a community sells, how much time is given to the residents to buy that park. And we'll see how we'll try to work it out in the next couple meetings and see what we can come up with.
Thank you. I wish you well in those negotiations. And just so that the committee is clear, the committee bill that we're introducing today is only, there's only one part drafted, and that's the sub-metering part, but we want to get it into the system as a committee bill. So we'll be introducing that today with the understanding that the conversion portion will be amended, and we'll see what happens with the opportunity to purchase or right of first refusal, depending on how you look at it. Are there questions of Senator Girard?
The question is cost. What is the cost to put in one of these meters? This is affordable housing, so obviously you don't want to raise the overall cost of these for these pads. So what does it run on average, say, for, you're saying, 200 spaces or more to put in? How much does it cost per meter?
Senator Girard, this is the issue that we've spent probably the last year talking about the most. And you're looking, depending on the type of meter that you're going to put into a community, you're talking anywhere from $200 to maybe $600 per space.
Wow.
For a meter. And you start talking about communities that have 200, 250 spaces. That is a lot of money. And fortunately, the chair was willing to work with us on that, recognizing that because of the financial crisis, a lot of these larger communities just simply don't have the ability to finance that type of cost. And I think the residents in those communities came to the realization that that was something that they did not want to acquire at this time. But we're confident that once we get beyond the current financial crisis and it'll be more affordable, even for smaller communities, to do that.
And I want to clarify.
Got a couple points. So, Senator Girard, we spent a lot of time, and the chair actually spent a lot of time trying to find financing sources or subsidy sources. And we talked to everybody in the state and some national contacts as well. I want to make the point, both sides want sub-metering.
Yeah.
Both sides view sub-metering as the future and the best way to go for both of them, in financial interest. What we've done here is, in this proposed bill, is to address your question, two things. One, we've created some exemptions from the sub-metering requirement. And that will benefit a couple of the large landlords who find that or feel that that sub-metering is cost prohibitive. So we've created something we're calling the super conservation pro rata method, in which they take some extra steps and they don't have to sub-meter. So there is an exemption now that would be built into the law. And then finally, we've created a method of financing it within the park so that landlords can have a special assessment over a 60-month period, at least, to recover the cost from the residents. We think that's bearable for the residents over that period of time, and it would repay the landlord for the cost of submetering.
Right, and just to clarify, based on the research that we did in submetering, this is a follow-up to a bill that we passed in 09, the potential savings from submetering because of the conservation should pretty much offset the cost that's passed along in the monthly payments over 60 months for the cost of installing the submeters.
I'm not sure I would that assumption I would find kind of surprising, but why not, you know, this is just me, but it would just seem to me like, especially in this economy right now, that if you had a bill that would have new facilities, that would be a requirement in new facilities, because we know that's something of the future, and then give a pretty long timeline for the other ones to meet that requirement. I just don't want to see short timelines. That's pretty much it.
So, Senator Troy, I could say that the bill does include a requirement that future new parks would have to be sub-metered, so that we skip right to the solution there. The other point to make, I guess, is there aren't that many parks that are affected by this, the mandatory sub-metering, frankly, because there aren't that many large parks, and we're building in two exemptions. One is for those that are just on well water, because the cost isn't as significant for those on well water. And the second is the super conservation pro rata method. So we think we have landlord support for this approach.
just to follow up, Senator, with the landlord community, we generally support this legislation, and certainly we've spent a lot of time with Senator Bonamici on this issue, and I think we came up with a reasonable compromise that we can support. As John said, we're talking about maybe 5 or 6 large manufactured home communities in the state. There's an exemption for all the other communities that are 200 spaces or less, and we've clarified the process of how a community transitions from in the rent or pro rata method of billing water to sub-metering. That has been clarified, and we've also clarified with the state safe drinking water program that we can sub-meter water, which is a huge plus for us. So I think generally those folks who own communities in Oregon are once we get past this financial crisis and money is more affordable, are probably going to convert to water sub-metering. There's no doubt about the benefits.
But this bill, Senator Girod, actually allows them time. If the bill doesn't go into effect, they have to sub-meter based on the 2009 legislation. So this is basically an exemption with some additional requirements for conservation. Any other questions? And then, so Mr. Van Lanningham, you want to do the landlord tenant coalition,
please? The second bill that we're asking the committee to introduce is from the general landlord tenant coalition. It's a separate coalition. There's some overlap of members. And I often refer to it as the Apartment Landlord Tenant Coalition. It's been in existence for a lot longer, the early 1980s, and it's had a bill since 1983 in every session except 1991, when we agreed not to do a bill. This session, this bill is smaller and less contentious and complex, partly to reflect the fact that the 2009 coalition, general coalition bill was complex and controversial, and we feel like we need some time to swallow what passed in 2009. There are 9 issues addressed in that bill. I've given you a memo that outlines those 9 issues. This group, again, had an agreement going in that it wouldn't do complicated or complex issues. There's only one issue that falls into that category, and I can talk about it if you want to hear about it, but it's the sort of thing that only lawyers would love.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
We're off to negotiate further.
Well wishes. Next we have John Mangan to talk about the Life Insurance Interstate Compact. And come on up. Again, committee members, an overview of a committee bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm a Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers, and we very much appreciate you taking a look at this proposed legislation, which adopts the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Compact. Let's just call it the Compact for short. This bill is a model bill created by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It was created in 2006, and I'll tell you why it was created for 2 reasons. One is that we have a system of state regulation in place for our companies that is, in terms of product approval, very difficult, expensive, and hard to navigate. 56 different jurisdictions look at our products, review them, and have to approve them before we go to market. 56 jurisdictions have their own laws, their own regulations, and their own quirks with regard to those regulations. The process of getting products approved is tedious at best. In some cases, it could take years to get your product on the market. This compact was meant to create a single point of filing that allows companies, national companies, for instance, such as Standard Life of Portland, to go national to get their products approved by one regulator and have it basically approved with reciprocity in the rest of the states. The regulators like this idea, number one, because it essentially took off their plate a lot of this busy work and allowed the regulators to focus on much more important things such as consumer protection, market conduct, financial regulation, and products that frankly needed more rather than less review. So in 2006, this compact idea was created, and since then, 38 states have joined the compact, which represents about 67% of the national premium for these products. These are life products, annuity products, disability income, and long-term care. All of these are voluntarily purchased products in the marketplace, financial protection products. We think that this bill will really help our companies, both domestic and out-of-state companies, sell more products, offer more options to consumers, pay more taxes to the state of Oregon because our revenues should be enhanced over time, and provide a better product, in essence, for the state of Oregon and for its consumers. a couple things about the compact. Because it's a model bill, it really needs to be adopted as is. If you have issues with it, legislators can opt out of certain provisions if they wish up front. We don't recommend that. But it's basically, you kind of have to, if you like the concept, adopt the bill. You can't really go in and amend it. If so, you don't become a member of the compact. When you do become a member, then the state of Oregon actually gets a seat at the table at the compact commission, which oversees this filing process. So each state regulator is a member once the state joins, and they oversee the process of product approval. So you're definitely involved in that. And a state regulator or a state legislature can, over time, decide to opt out or change its role if it doesn't, if it's not happy with what's happening in terms of consumer protection. But the bottom line is the standards that were created for these national filings are, frankly, they meet or exceed the standards that are in place in any given state, which is deliberate so that states will look at this and say, you know, this is not a dumbing down of our consumer protection. In fact, it may be actually a better set of protections than we have in place. So with those things in mind, of course, we very much appreciate your looking favorably on introducing this and supporting it next year.
Thank you so much. Questions? Mayor Gerard?
I always have a question. The question I have is, if you watch TV, you see life insurance policies. You can't be denied because of your health and all that. Mm-hmm. Is that going to come into play with this bill that maybe, it's one of those things that always sounds too good to be true, and I'm sure it is. Is that going to kind of cut into those insurance programs?
Madam Chair and Senator Gerard, it shouldn't affect any existing program in a negative way. I mean, I really don't see any downside to this. What this allows is that companies that offer those products still have to get approval from state regulators here in Oregon.
Right.
Instead of doing it through the state division of insurance, they do it through a national point of filing. And the standards in that policy will have to meet or exceed, in essence, Oregon standards, and they will get approved and probably get it to market faster.
Okay.
Which means they'll probably sell more life insurance, which, as you know, generates more premium revenue, more tax revenue here in the state of Oregon. So it should be an upside.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much
for
your testimony. Because I'm about to lose at least one of the committee members, I'm going to go ahead and open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measures and want the committee members to be reminded that votes are traditionally cast in favor of the bill introduction as a courtesy and not necessarily indicative of a member's position with regard to the subject of the bill.
Thank you.
So with that... Senator Rosenbaum?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 980, dated November 15th of 2010. LC 2649, dated December 6th, 2010. LC 2651, dated December 8th, 2010. And LC 3046, which is dated December 8th of 2010.
Senator Rosenbaum moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 980, dated November 15, 2010. LC 2649, dated December 6, 2010. LC 2651, dated December 8, 2010. And LC 3046, dated December 8, 2010. Is there any discussion? Senator Gerard.
I'd like to make the same disclaimer. I will, as a courtesy, pass these along, but by no means does it mean, I haven't seen the bills, so by no means does it mean that I will support them on the floor. I will not be on this committee any longer, so, but it just, it's a courtesy and that's it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I just want to clarify that LC 980 is the work group bill on free trial offers that we've heard about a lot in this committee, and I'll be doing just a brief summary of where we are on that bill later on. If there's no further discussion, is there any objection? The measures are introduced as committee bills, and I will close the work session and reopen the informational meeting. Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. All right, we're going to start with a panel on home foreclosure issues, but before we do that, I want to make some preliminary comments in advance of the testimony today for purposes of background. The issue that we're about to discuss is quite complex, but the bottom line is that families are suffering as they lose their homes, neighborhoods are affected, and property ownership rights may be clouded or unclear. There may be plenty of blame to go around, but I want to emphasize that casting blame is not why we're here today. We're here to identify issues and do our best to try to find solutions. There's, of course, reams of information about the causes of the financial crisis, about the history of subprime lending, bank bailouts, TARP, HAMP, loan modification programs, and whether they work or not. And obviously, we can't and won't get into details about all of these issues, but I've scheduled this hearing today to inform the committee about what's happening in Oregon, how foreclosure is affecting homeowners and financial institutions, and what the rights and responsibilities are of the affected parties. In 2009, we passed Senate Bill 628. We added to that in February of 2010 with House Bill 3610. These bills require a notice to homeowners in foreclosure, the opportunity for to apply for modification, a meeting to discuss mortgage modification, and an explanation of the reason why if there's a denial of a mortgage modification. This hearing today is intended to give us an opportunity to hear how these bills are working, to learn whether changes need to be made. Some of the issues that our constituents are concerned about include being on a dual track where they're going through foreclosure while at the same time trying to determine whether they can modify their mortgage to avoid foreclosure. We have seen or read about what CNN calls the produce the note issue, which asks whether a bank has the right to foreclose without showing that it has fully documented legal ownership rights. When the housing market depends on the ability to convey clear title, is this a mere technicality or is it a substantive legal property right? Both the bankruptcy and federal courts in Oregon have recently called into question the authority of MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, who we will hear from shortly, casting doubt on what role MERS can play in foreclosure. In fact, some courts have referred to MERS as a straw man rather than a party with all the rights of a buyer. As we consider these issues, I believe that some background will be useful. And I want to read some excerpts from the executive summary of the November 16, 2010 Congressional Oversight Panel report, which is titled Examining the Consequences of Mortgage Irregularities for Financial Stability and Foreclosure Mitigation. And bear with me, I think this is important background. In the fall of 2010, reports began to surface alleging that companies servicing $6.4 trillion in American mortgages may have bypassed legally required steps to foreclose on a home. Allegations of robo-signing are deeply disturbing and have given rise to ongoing federal and state investigations. At this point, the ultimate implications remain unclear. It's possible, however, that robo-signing may have concealed much deeper problems in the mortgage market that could potentially threaten financial stability and undermine the government's efforts to mitigate the foreclosure crisis. In the best-case scenario, concerns about mortgage documentation irregularities may prove overblown. In this view, which has been embraced by the financial industry, a handful of employees failed to follow procedures in signing foreclosure-related affidavits. But the facts underlying the affidavits are demonstrably accurate. Foreclosures could proceed as soon as the invalid affidavits are replaced with properly executed paperwork. The worst-case scenario is considerably grimmer. In this view, which has been articulated by academics and homeowner advocates, the robo-signing of affidavits served to cover up the fact that loan servicers cannot demonstrate the facts required to conduct a lawful foreclosure. In essence, banks may be unable to prove that they own the mortgage loans they claim to own. Nowadays, a single mortgage loan may be sold dozens of times between various banks across the country. In the view of some market participants, the sheer speed of the modern mortgage market has rendered obsolete the traditional ink and paper recordation process. So the financial industry developed an electronic transfer process that bypasses county property offices. This electronic process has, however, faced legal challenges that could, in an extreme scenario, call into question the validity of 33 million mortgage loans. Further, the financial industry now commonly bundles the rights of thousands of individual loans into mortgage-backed securities. The securitization process is complicated and requires several properly executed transfers. If at any point the required legal steps are not followed to the letter, then the ownership of the mortgage loan could fall into question. Homeowner advocates have alleged that frequent robo-signing of ownership affidavits may have concealed extensive industry failures to document mortgage loan transfers properly. If documentation problems prove to be pervasive, and more importantly, throw into doubt the ownership of not only foreclosed properties but also pooled mortgages, the consequences could be severe. Clear and uncontested property rights are the foundation of the housing market. If these rights fall into question, that foundation could collapse. Borrowers may be unable to determine whether they are sending their monthly payments to the right people. Judges may block any effort to foreclose, even in cases where borrowers have failed to make regular payments. Multiple banks may attempt to foreclose upon the same property. Borrowers who have already suffered foreclosure may seek to regain title to their home and force any new owners to move out. Would-be buyers and sellers could find themselves in limbo, unable to know with certainty whether they can safely buy or sell a home. If such problems were to arise on a large scale, the housing market could experience even greater disruptions than have already occurred, resulting in significant harm to major financial institutions. In addition to documentation concerns, another problem has arisen with securitized mortgage loans that could also threaten financial stability. Investors in mortgage-backed securities typically demanded certain assurances about the quality of the loans they purchased, for instance, that the borrowers had certain minimum credit ratings and income, or that their homes had appraised for at least a minimum value. Allegations have surfaced that banks may have misrepresented the quality of many loans sold for securitization. Banks found to have provided misrepresentations could be required to repurchase any affected mortgages. Because millions of these mortgages are in default or foreclosure, the result could be extensive capital losses if such repurchase risk is not adequately reserved. The panel emphasizes that mortgage lenders and securitization servicers should not undertake to foreclose on any homeowner unless they are able to do so in full compliance with applicable laws and their contractual agreements with the homeowner. The American financial system is in a precarious place. So that's from the congressional report. I wanted to provide that. I know it was lengthy, but I wanted to provide it as background for the committee and for the people who are testifying to understand who the scope of the issues. And I just wanted to add one more thing to consider before I call up the first panel, and that's that the Association of Mortgage Investors represents private investors and also public and private pension funds. Well, they're on record supporting efforts to find ways to avert foreclosure. In a November 16, 2010 press release, they said that modification programs, quote, have often proved unsuccessful due to the servicers, who invariably are the second lien holders and continue to inhibit sustainable modifications. Mortgage investors have no control over the modification process and therefore share many of the frustrations that homeowners and state attorneys general are experiencing when dealing with mortgage servicers. So I know there's a lot of complex issues. I wanted to sort of set the stage with some of them that were identified by the congressional panel, because I thought that they really spelled out the scope of the issues. And with this background in mind, and also with, again, the reminder that we're not here to cast blame, but to try to identify issues and find solutions, I'd like to call up the first panel that we'll have today, and that is R.K. Arnold, who is the Chief Executive Officer of MERS, and Paul Leonard from the Center for Responsible Lending. And as you're coming up to the dais, I'd like to ask everyone testifying today if you could do your best to avoid using acronyms. I know I did that a bit. It may be helpful for those who don't have the background. Probably most of the people in this room are very familiar with all of the issues, but not everyone is. So if you could either avoid using acronyms or be sure to explain what they are, I think that would be very helpful as we go through the testimony. And we'll start with Mr. Arnold. Welcome, and welcome to Oregon.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici. I appreciate the invitation.
If you want to state your name for the record, please, and then if you could explain to us what MERS is and what you do, that would be helpful to the committee. Thank you.
My name is R.K. Arnold. I'm President and Chief Executive Officer of MERS. Let me start by just giving a brief explanation of what MERS is. We have 3,000 members, which are most, if not all, of the mortgage lenders in the United States. MERS maintains a nationwide database that tracks changes to servicing rights and ownership interests. It's a benefit to the mortgage industry because it's the only source of a uniquely identified mortgage loan. It's a benefit to consumers because it provides a toll-free 1-800 number and web access to find out who the current servicer of their loan is. It's a benefit to communities because the MERS database helps the communities keep track of dilapidated property, empty property, if you will. And finally, the MERS database is a benefit to law enforcement because it helps them detect fraud not only by borrowers but also by lenders. We do this by MERS serving as a common agent in the public land records for all 3,000 of our members. That's by way of a mortgage that's signed by the borrower, making MERS the mortgagee of record, or in this case, the beneficiary of a deed of trust. Again, that's recorded in the land records. That makes MERS the mortgagee as nominee on behalf of the lender and the lender's successors and assigns. That mortgage also gives MERS the authority to foreclose. Now, when it comes to foreclosure, there's two ways for a foreclosure to be done if it's a MERS registered loan. That can either be assigned to the servicer or the note holder, and that would be recorded in the land records. At that point, MERS plays no role at all. Or the foreclosure can be initiated in the name of MERS because we are the beneficiary of the deed of trust. In all those scenarios, the same people do all the work and make all the same decisions. So the servicer is doing everything themselves, either in their own name or as an officer of MERS. There are no differences in the decision-making process. To become a certifying officer, you have to pass an exam, and you have to also be an officer of the servicer who employs you. So there are requirements, and we track who the certifying officers are. MERS derives no revenue from foreclosure, and we do not decide when a foreclosure will be initiated. That's done by the servicer. With regard to how a foreclosure is done in the name of MERS, our requirements are as strict as the strictest state, essentially. 5 years ago, we instituted a requirement that the promissory note must be available during the foreclosure. Many, many states do not have that requirement, but if it's going to be foreclosed in the name of MERS, it must. The corollary to that is you cannot file a lost note affidavit because that's just an excuse not to present the note. So we believe that, in part because of those stricter requirements, we believe that there are very few foreclosures that are initiated in the name of MERS nowadays. There are many in the pipeline, but we don't think that there are that many that are initiated going forward. In summary, we understand that owning your home is the American dream and that losing that home is a nightmare. And we care about the impact that this entire process has on homeowners. That being said, we are saving consumers money. We're providing a benefit to the mortgage industry, of course. We are providing benefits to communities and to law enforcement. And the MERS system, we believe, can play an important role in helping this committee address whatever your concerns are.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a question and then ask the committee for questions, and then we'll hear from Mr. Leonard. And I just want to point out, you've handed us some voluminous testimony and information that we haven't had an opportunity to review yet. So thank you. I appreciate that. We'll take a look at that. When you talked about how there are two ways for MERS to foreclose, and one of them is assigned back to the servicer, and one of them, MERS, initiates the foreclosure. But you said that in both situations, the same work is done by the same people. So I guess I want to follow up on that a little bit and ask you to explain that. If the same work is done by the same people, then why would MERS initiate the foreclosure rather than just have the servicer do it?
It's the lender's choice, even the investor's choice or the servicer's choice. They can decide to leave the land record showing that MERS is the beneficiary of the deed of trust, or they can decide that it's going to be assigned and they would do it themselves. The difference, to be frank with you, could be because they don't want to answer questions about MERS. The difference could be they believe that that's the most efficient way to go about the foreclosure.
And just as a follow-up, if I'm trying to figure out the efficiency point, if it's, you said it's the same work done by the same people. I'm
yes.
trying to understand how that decision is made and why.
The decision to have the two options.
So the decision, you said it's the lender servicer's decision whether they have the assignment back to them or whether MERS initiate the foreclosure.
Yes.
Okay. Well, maybe I should ask the lender servicers when they're up here, but if it's the same work being done by the same people, and I'm just trying to understand why, what factors go into making that decision.
Yeah, and frankly, I would not be able to answer for them. I would say that from a legal perspective, there's no difference between the two. In either case, it's the beneficiary of the deed of trust that is pursuing the foreclosure. For one thing, there would be an assignment that would be recorded in the land records, and that would incur a fee, and that fee would have to be paid ultimately by the consumer. So one benefit to foreclosing in the name of MERS is that there's not an additional recording fee that the consumer is going to have to pay. But again, it is a fact that the same people are doing the same work in both scenarios. They're wearing one of two hats, and as I said, the certifying officer has to be an officer of the servicer, and they also have to pass an exam and be appointed an officer by MERS. So whether they foreclose as an officer of the servicer or they foreclose as an officer of MERS, in both cases, it's the same officer, it's the same workers, it goes through the same servicing system. There's no additional information that comes from MERS, either by way of authority or by way of information. We don't know whether the loan is in default or not.
You said that when there's an assignment from MERS back to the investor, to the lender or servicer,
yes,
there, that requires a fee that would ultimately have to be paid by the consumer.
That would be charged by the county.
Right. That's for the assignment from MERS back to the servicer.
That's correct.
So if there's MERS is in the transaction from the beginning, correct?
Yes.
When the consumer takes out the loan, you said MERS is, I forgot the word that you said, disclosed in the document at the beginning?
Yes, in the deed of trust.
So then, after the note in these mortgages that are sold multiple times, the note is sold, is that, MERS tracks that, correct?
Yes.
I'm trying to understand this. So every time that the note is sold, is that recorded as well?
No, and that never was. In the history of the country, that those notes were never recorded. The way that, just to give you some perspective about how MERS tracks these interests, it's done through electronic handshakes. So if either the servicing or the note is sold, the selling company, goes into the MERS system and posits a transfer. And then the receiving company goes in to the database and accepts that. In all cases, MERS remains in the land records. So to think of what MERS is legally, we serve as the common agent in the land records on behalf of all 3,000 members. Then we operate an electronic database where those members update that database and inform MERS which particular one of them we're serving for at any particular moment with regard to a specific loan. And that way, the interests are accurately tracked, and it all boils down to where the mail goes to. Because if you're in the land records, then you are entitled under the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, and probably Oregon law, to receive legal notice of process. So the legal sanctity of that property cannot be affected without service of process. Well, that's going to come to MERS. When it comes to MERS, we receive all this mail for all our members. We turn it into electronic form and we send it. It's very efficient. We send it to the servicer. The correct servicer, not the one that is trailing two or three transactions behind. When we have servicers box up, what I call box up in the middle of the night, you're all aware that that happens. They disappear. Well, what's a homeowner supposed to do? You have to still make your payments because somebody is owed the money, but you don't know where to send it. The MERS system, in that scenario, the most recent one was Taylor Bean & Whitaker, which was a very large servicer, just boxed up in the middle of the night. The FDIC typically has a successor already lined up before they go in. That's their preference. So they would update the MERS system. And overnight, the MERS system would now reflect that any legal notice needs to go to the new servicer. So the homeowner would have no blip at all. MERS is disclosed on the deed of trust. There's a toll-free number on there. That's free. They can also access MERS on the web, and MERS would tell them who the new servicer is and give them contact information, four pieces of information about the new servicer. Then they can verify with that servicer whether they're supposed to send their payment and all of that. MERS wouldn't be involved anymore at that point. One of the main reasons, in fact, part of the charter documents of the creation of MERS, would that there would always be toll-free, it was before the web really, toll-free access for consumers. It was always considered to be a major benefit for consumers. It's turned out that it's an even larger benefit for the title industry because if you're familiar with that business, a lot of their time is spent what I call bouncing around trying to find who is the actual party. Because they're going to insure over the transaction. So it's a big asset for the title industry too, because it's a very accurate check on who the real parties in interest are. Then you can take it from there. You have information, so you're armed, And then with regard to what you mentioned earlier about modifications, knowing who the servicer is and the investor is are the two keys to getting a modification. MERS plays no role in a modification at all, except that we're a very accurate piece of information about who the servicer is and who the investor is. And those are the only two parties, excepting government intervention, those are the only two parties that could work out a modification with a homeowner.
Thank you. And just to clarify for me and the committee, maybe everybody else understands this, but I want to make sure I understand. There's a pretty large percentage of mortgages now that are with MERS or through MERS. Is that correct?
Yes. We estimate that about 50% of the mortgage loans out there in the country are registered on MERS.
And for those that aren't, how do they track who holds the note?
No one tracks that. In fact, one of the most, out of 15 years of running MERS, probably the most amazing question I've ever been asked was 2 years ago when we talked to the federal government regulators and they asked us how many loans there were out there. It was really surprising to me that there's no first-hand knowledge about how many loans there are out there. You would have to get information from each lender, add it together, and then you get into double counting because during your opening you mentioned that they sell numerous times. So one says they have it and the other's double counting it. You could be triple counting it. So the only record that we're aware of, and again, it's only half of the loans out there, is the MERS system. This system could be harnessed in a way that could deliver much better information to consumers and to government. But again, we only have 50% of the loans that are registered on the system. Let me finish that thought by saying you fundamentally have more information about a loan that's registered on the MERS system, both downstream, as we would call it, ultimately to the consumer, and upstream, all the way up into the secondary market, than you would on a non-registered MERS loan. If the Taylor, Bean, and Whitaker loans had not been registered on MERS, and they boxed up in the middle of the night, you're looking at a minimum of a six-month mess where homeowners would not be sure where they needed to send their money.
And I just have one more question for now. I might have more after Mr. Leonard's testimony. You said that the note has to be provided when MERS is involved or initiates a foreclosure, and you don't use any loss note affidavit.
That's correct.
I just wanted to clarify that. And has that always been the MERS policy?
5 years or so. As our database, again, MERS is a database, and so we're thinking database, and that, of course, ultimately gives you the ability to see trends. And it became obvious to us in 2005 that there were an inordinate number of loss note affidavits. Plus, we found that when the note is not present, you wind up, there's this question about where is the note? And the way I was trained, it's a promissory note, you signed it, whoever holds that note, you must pay them. But at the end of the day, once you pay it, you should get it back, and it should be stamped paid. And that was the sum total, really, of what we were thinking as far as putting in the requirement, because it didn't make sense to us that there would be a foreclosure without a promissory note. And then very soon after that, we realized that a loss note affidavit is just an excuse to not bring in the note.
And if you, I know I said that was my last question, but another way, if for some reason the note cannot be located, what do you do? Do you just assign it back to the servicer, or do you just keep looking for the note until you?
proposed?
Well, we don't have the notes. MERS doesn't keep any documents at all, except, you know, normal corporate-type documents. So we don't have the notes. And so when one of our members files an affidavit saying the note is lost, well, you know, we don't know whether it's been lost or not, and in any event, we don't want to be involved in that. You need to keep track of your notes. So every state that I'm aware of has some sort of a provision where you can enforce a debt if you've lost the note. So we don't really have a problem with that. What we saw was that it was epidemic in the industry that they were saying the note was lost, when in fact it just was not lost. It's in custody somewhere. What's going on there is, this is my own personal opinion, I suppose, but you know, you have to pay a fee to get it out of custody. You'd have to pay a fee to FedEx it, and then it's going to be carried around by some bank officer or some lawyer and could get lost. And so I think years ago, 10, 15, 20 years ago or longer, the industry started saying, well, let's file lost note affidavits so we don't take that chance. Well, MERS just didn't want to be part of that. So in a foreclosure, to keep questions to a minimum, again, if I may throw in here, the MERS system over-disclosed. We're the ones that say on the deed of trust that we're nominee for the lender. There's no question what role we're playing there. And then likewise during foreclosure, why have MERS involved in a foreclosure where the promissory note is not there? So to answer your question, if you've actually lost the note, then you would have to assign it and record that in the public land records and take MERS out of the mix. And that could be another reason that we don't think there are all that many foreclosures being initiated anew in the name of MERS, because they wouldn't be able to go without that note.
I think that answered my question. I'll ponder. Senator Girard.
I only have a couple questions. The first question I have, I've kind of got a sense of what you're about, but you made the statement that in the case of somebody boxing up and leaving, which I would assume would be a bankruptcy, and I have a little familiar with bankruptcies, tell me again how it cuts through the chase, because in a bankruptcy court, there's creditors, and how you could say this money goes to so-and-so and not somebody else. I don't understand how that can be done. Now, maybe with FDIC, it could go directly to FDIC, but I'm just trying to figure out what if a lending institution went bankrupt, how do you know instantaneously where to send that check?
Well, the FDIC is automatically the successor in interest on a bank that they take over, unless they move that directly to the new bank. And so the MERS system would be updated that evening to make sure that the mail went to the proper location. The if there is a bankruptcy proceeding, you're fundamentally correct that the purpose of that is to marshal the assets and to protect the creditors, particularly the unsecured creditors.
Okay. One more question.
Okay.
And just correct me if I'm wrong, but you get involved in a foreclosure if the lender wishes you to do so. If that's the case, it's just so basically you're acting as a third party, then, which kind of gets them off the hook. Is that sort of what you're doing?
Well, again, it's the same people that are making the decisions, and they are doing all that work during the foreclosure process. If it's contested, if you will, the lender and the servicer will all be disclosed during that foreclosure. So to the extent that the question is asked, then those answers would be given. But fundamentally, it's that the foreclosure is being done in both cases by the beneficiary of the deed of trust. So there's really no question legally. So either way is proper.
Okay. One last question.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, I'm still trying to track this. Can you tell me then why do you think under a MERS agreement that there would be less foreclosures?
One reason is because we require that the promissory note be presented. And if you are from a state where that's not a requirement, then that's going to be a significant financial burden on the servicer that is present with the MERS foreclosure as opposed to one in their own name. So that could cause them to want to assign it out of MERS and back into their own name in the land records. Another thing is, as the chair pointed out in her opening, there has been a lot of press about MERS, and the servicer could just simply determine that they don't want to do it in the name of MERS for reasons that they don't want to encounter the question.
Other questions? Madam Burdick? Mr. Leonard, I notice that your testimony is pretty comprehensive, but at this point, if you want to start out with a consumer perspective on the MERS issue, that would be helpful.
Sure. My name is Paul Leonard. Is this on?
Yes.
And I am the California director of the Center for Responsible Lending. The center is a national nonprofit policy and research organization focused on eliminating abusive lending practices targeted primarily at low and moderate income households. We're affiliated with a national community development financial institution called Self-Help, which itself has, over its 30-year lifetime, has made some $5.6 billion of investments to some 64,000 families for homeownership, small businesses, and nonprofit organizations. Let me just say, first of all, that I am neither a lawyer, nor am I a PhD in MERS. I think that the structure of MERS is a it is an interesting and complicated one, and one which I don't profess to be an expert on. What I think about MERS is that it does in fact complicate the process of foreclosures to some extent. Although I think that Mr. Arnold's testimony has sort of pointed out, I think the challenges of the foreclosure process, I think, rest primarily with servicers and not with MERS as an institution itself, as a recording institution itself. I think in some cases it obscures the ownership of the loan for an individual borrower or for organizations like mine that are tracking records where foreclosures are initiated in the name of MERS. It's very hard to know at that point which entity is actually involved and behind the foreclosures. But I think that the problems around this foreclosure process go far beyond the question of MERS, the issues around robo-signings and around the appropriate chain of title and the needs to produce a note in due course before showing a proper ownership right to establish the right to foreclose are critically important, complicated legal issues that are in the process of being sorted out in state courts all across the country and by regulators and attorneys general. As you all know, there are the 50 state attorney generals have launched a comprehensive investigation into servicer practices that was originally triggered by the robo-signing crisis around foreclosures, but has now clearly gone much, much deeper to review the entire process by which servicers manage their duties to borrowers and investors. In addition, all of the federal regulatory agencies are working together on a comprehensive investigation into these issues. So my own view is these are extraordinarily complex legal issues. Again, I'm not a lawyer. They are being sorted out in due time, but I think are raise some serious questions about how the mortgage process works and how the foreclosure process works.
and particularly the role of servicer that the servicers play as kind of the sort of intermediary in this process, and what their degree of accountability is going forward.
Thank you. I might have. Were you finished with that point?
Yeah.
I have a question because you said that you thought that the involvement of MERS complicated foreclosures, which certainly for those that have ended up in the litigation, that it complicates it. And you said that it obscures the ownership of the loan, which seems to be contradictory to what Mr. Arnold said. So from your perspective, when you see a transaction that has MERS, is it difficult for you to, can you just like go log onto the MERS website and find out who's the owner?
To my understanding, and Mr. Arnold may be able to correct me, but my understanding is that folks who are not involved, not a party to this transaction, don't have access to know who the ownership is and that is initiating the foreclosure process when it's initiated on behalf of MERS. The other thing that I would point out that I find interesting, and again, I'm not an expert in the model, but it is an interesting and confusing point that the folks who are filing foreclosures on behalf of MERS are people who work for the servicers. And so they are recording their actions on behalf of MERS as officers of MERS. At the very same time, they are officially paid by and the employees of the servicing organizations. At a minimum, that strikes me as being confusing.
Mr.
Well,
Arnold?
If to hit the last point, it's common for employees to be officers of more than one company, and that is fundamental to our model. So, I guess the whether or not that's confusing, I think, has to do with looking at the deed of trust. The deed of trust says that MERS can foreclose, and in that scenario, that's who's foreclosing. So that seems, that's actually more correct than doing it the other way if you look at the actual documents itself. As far as who is initiating the foreclosure, there may be a bit of a disconnect because in the case, which we think is the very small number, but that there are foreclosures done in the name of MERS, the MERS system, which is free, toll-free, and web, will tell you who the servicer is. The servicer is the one that's initiating the foreclosure. So we don't make that point, but yes, it's being done in the name of MERS, but you can look on the MERS system and see who the servicer is, and the homeowner knows who the servicer is. The information that's not available publicly is that information, for example, Social Security number, the amount of the loan, private information. The information, we would err on the side of making more information available because we wouldn't want to encounter the problem that he is suggesting. So one of the things that could be, it could be as simple as cooperating between the two of us and us, you know, expressly telling them or giving them a report of who the servicer is with regard to that foreclosure. But it is publicly available on the system by toll-free and over the web.
Okay, so anybody could just log on to MERS and say, in this particular foreclosure, this is the lender, this is the servicer.
Yes.
Okay.
I think it highlights another issue that, in fact, that hopefully will be corrected by the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill, which there is not a single composite federal database on foreclosures that we have. And so foreclosure data is generally collected and maintained at the county level. Filings are made at the county level. And I would just add that when a county level record indicates that MERS is in fact, the entity that is foreclosing, it is a significant additional step to then go back to MERS, especially for the context of doing research to understand who are the players involved in, who are the entities that are involved in foreclosing, to then take a separate step to match whatever county records say to a separate publicly available website of MERS data is a significant challenge.
Well, as I mentioned, we could probably help streamline that in that regard for an organization such as his. We have up in the northeastern United States, there's a newsletter, I forget the name of it, but they report numbers of loans that are being made out there, and initially it showed MERS as the biggest one, and so we do have we have cooperated before to make sure that it doesn't disrupt their line of business, because they don't need to report MERS as the biggest lender because we don't loan. So we help correct that with the newsletter, and we could also probably work with your organization to make sure that that wasn't a burdensome second step.
I just want to ask another clarification question, just to make sure I understand this correctly. If the foreclosure is done in the name of MERS, it's actually being done by the, what are they called, certifying officer who is with the servicer.
Yes.
And they're paid by the servicer, and they're employed by the servicer. They're
yes.
not paid by or employed by MERS.
No, they're not, and they're officers of the servicer.
Thank you.
So, for example, let's say the division manager for mortgages would probably be an officer of that servicer and an officer of MERS.
Any other questions? Senator Girard.
Oh, interesting topic. The secondary market just seems like that's where everything's fouled up, because you have absolutely no comprehension of who has what loan, and I personally have experienced that. So the question I would have for both of you is, the problem that we had was that from a corporate entity, a predator bought the secondary market loan. Now, if that happens, are you just going to be a front for the predator, or how does that work? And the second thing, question I would have, federally, is there any regulations coming down the pipeline? You mentioned the Dodd-Frank bill. I don't know if that's going to go through, but is there anything that's going to correct the secondary market where things, you have no idea who's buying what, and it, when you sign on for a mortgage, it's kind of disheartening to find out your competitor buys your mortgage up.
Well, with regard to your first question, Senator, we would not knowingly want to be involved with anyone who was engaged in wrongdoing.
But that's not wrongdoing, is it?
Well, you mentioned the predator, did you not?
Yeah, but the predator has the right to do that. I don't think that that's wrong in a statutory sense. I just think it's wrong morally. But there are just a fair number of predators out there doing that, and that's what really bothers me. And then if you're acting as a front for that predator, that would even make it more disheartening.
Well, and I think there is the dilemma that you mentioned. What's the difference between different holders in due course? We're operating as an agent for the holder in due course. But the reason I said it the way I did is I took from your question some ability to determine who was and was not engaged in wrongdoing, and we would not want to be engaged in anything where there was any wrongdoing. But when it comes to just a holder in due course, then we are the agent in the land records for the holder of that loan until there's an assignment in the land records taking us out. As far as what's happening on the federal level, you're probably aware that I've testified before the Senate and the House. The questions seem to be focused on securitization or the secondary market, which MERS doesn't play any role in that other than to be the common agent in the land records. The other primary focus seems to be on modifications, and with regard to the this consortium of attorney generals. It's my understanding from Tom Miller's testimony before the Senate that their primary focus is on modifications as well. And again, MERS plays no role there. So that would be the extent to what I would know about either of those topics.
And just for clarification, Tom Miller is the one who's leading the Attorney General investigation?
He is the Attorney General for Iowa, and I believe is their leader on this issue.
Any other questions? Senator Girard.
Well, back to the secondary market, and this is, again, I'm not trying to beat a dead horse, but what's happening is, at least from my personal experience, is that say that you have 1,000 loans out in a bank, and it's deemed to be fairly high-risk loans, they'll bundle that, then they'll sell it on a secondary market to someone that will buy it, say, at 50 cents on the dollar, and then they have... it's in their best interest to foreclose. So, and what bothers me a little bit about what you're saying that your company does is it just acts like it might be a forefront the person. I just have a real hard time with that. That's all.
Well, the. Again, that's the servicer that would be doing that either in their own name or in the name of MERS. So whether MERS was involved or not, it wouldn't be different from that standpoint. If I could make a distinction about what you said about securitization. Securitization, I think of as being the... When loans are bundled and securitized like that, I think the buyers of those securities are thinking it's worth the face value of what's been bundled. Your reference strikes me as more related to what you would think of as dent and scratch, and that would be a group of loans that it's understood that the likelihood of repayment is significantly different than it used to be, and that's where you would pay less for that. So I understand your point, and that is that there may be a motivation there to foreclose. And so I think, again, in that scenario, that's going to be done by the servicer regardless of whether MERS is involved or not, and the extent of our involvement would be we operate that system that will tell you who the servicer is. You can still raise, whether it's MERS or the servicer, you can raise any defenses you have to payment in that foreclosure.
Thank you. I have an additional question to Mr. Arnold. It's my understanding, and this is far from my area of expertise, it's my understanding that some states, like Washington, for example, requires that a beneficiary be a holder of the instrument or document, like the note. But Oregon only requires that the beneficiary be the person named on the trust deed as the person for whose benefit a trust deed is given. So that's a distinction. Does that distinction, the statutory requirement that the beneficiary hold the note, does that make a difference in how what MERS does or how MERS operates in various states?
Not in my view. To be a holder, you would not have to pay value to be a holder under the Uniform Commercial Code. So MERS has to be the holder in foreclosure, and because the promissory note has to be provided. So the mere designation of a holder, MERS can be the holder as well.
In foreclosure. Any other questions? Thank you very much, both of you, for your testimony. Appreciate it. And I know you both submitted lengthy written testimony, which we will review, and we appreciate that very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici.
And our next panel is going to be a panel of five. It's going to be pretty cozy up there, but we're going to have you all come up at the same time. Kevin Christensen from Oregon Bankers Association, Angela Martin from Economic Fairness Oregon, Gary Blackledge from Green and Markley, member of the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Section, Nania Takla, an attorney and a member of the Oregon State Bar Consumer Law Section, and Keith Ivanovich from the Department of Justice. And I'm going to alternate and go in that order. So I know it's a little cozy, but in the interest of getting everybody up here at once and making sure that you can respond to each other's concerns, I'm going to have Mr. Christensen go first from the Oregon Bankers Association, and then Angela Martin, and then Gary Blackledge, and then Nania, and then finally Keith.
So, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Christensen. I am the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Bankers Association. On behalf of our members, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. By way of background, the Oregon Bankers Association includes state and national commercial banks, savings banks, and trust companies chartered to do business in Oregon. The Oregon Bankers Association serves a dynamic, innovative, and community-minded industry. The dual charter system of banking involving both state and national charters is well utilized here in Oregon. It promotes strong, competitive banking system designed to maximize service to Oregonians. This morning we are here on behalf of our bank members who are loan servicers. We're here offering a bank perspective on current challenges in the home mortgage servicing environment. Before continuing, I believe it's helpful to highlight what a bank loan servicer does. First, a loan servicer's primary responsibility is to process payment from borrowers on their home mortgages. In the vast majority of cases, this is an administrative task involving processing and crediting payments. And also, in the vast majority of cases, timely payments are made by borrowers and credited to their accounts. Although loan servicers often also originate loans, many of our larger banking institutions who are loan servicers do not originate many of the loans they are now servicing. Second, the definition of a loan servicer is a general and fairly generic term. It can include commercial banks regulated nationally or those institutions regulated by the state of Oregon. Loan servicers can also include those entities that are not traditional banks and not represented by the Oregon Bankers Association. With that background in mind, I'll turn to the current foreclosure and mortgage loan servicing environment. The current environment has, regrettably, brought economic challenges to many Oregonians and to many Oregon banks. The loan servicers who are part of the commercial banking industry have recognized those challenges and continue to work diligently and quickly with their customers to find solutions when possible. While questions regarding foreclosure procedures have arisen during this economic downturn, it is important to put these circumstances into a greater overall context. It is also crucial to note that banks that service loans are constantly working to improve their effectiveness of the services they provide to their customers. I will highlight some of these efforts shortly, although I'd like to point out that documentation concerns are largely national in scale and involve federally supervised entities. Testimony presented at hearings that have taken place in Congress over the past month is readily available for the public to review. The overwhelming majority of loans in Oregon, home loans specifically, in Oregon around the country are current and on time. This is true despite the serious economic hardships that many face. Wells Fargo and Chase Bank report that 95% of their Oregon mortgage borrowers are current and on time. U.S. Bank reports that 96% of their Oregon home mortgage loans are current and on time. Bank of America reports that 86% of their home mortgage loans nationally are current and on time, but this figure also includes mortgages originated by Countrywide, which was not a commercial bank, before it was acquired by Bank of America. While this is not meant to minimize at all the struggles that some Oregonians face in paying their mortgage, it is very important to note that the vast majority of homeowners and home loans, both in Oregon and nationally, are current and on time. For those who have been unable to stay current in their mortgage loans, the economic environment is largely to blame. As a result of job losses and other factors, foreclosure has become an unfortunate reality for many people. I would emphasize that for our loan servicers, foreclosure is viewed as a measure of last resort. Banks who act as loan servicers do work hard to help their customers find solutions short of foreclosure. Our banks have actively worked with many customers to attempt to modify either loans either on a temporary or a permanent basis. thousands of Oregon loans have received temporary or permanent modifications that result in lower payments. For many, those modifications have been a helpful alternative. For others, the potential modification is still unsustainable given substantial lost income. Therefore, foreclosure is unfortunate and inevitable. Despite the impression given by media coverage of select cases outside the norm, many people that have faced foreclosure have failed to make payments in more than a year. Bank of America, for example, has 600,000 loans that they service that have not had a payment made in more than 1 year, and approximately 195,000 of those 600,000 loans have not had a payment made in 2 years. Other services report that in instances in which a home has gone to foreclosure, no payment, or is about to head to foreclosure, no payment has been made in 15 to 18 months on properties that have been foreclosed. Moreover, I might add that servicer has often made dozens of attempts to contact a borrower during this period. I would again emphasize that in most instances, foreclosure is viewed as a last resort to our member banks. It is expensive, and the underlying value of the property has substantially deteriorating. As mentioned above, our servicers are actively engaged in working with customers to avoid the need for foreclosure, and they will continue to do so whenever circumstances allow. That said, the reality is that many servicers were unprepared for the volume of foreclosures that they faced. Consequently, stories have been reported that allege problems with foreclosure documentation, and of course, those are claims that our servicers take very, very seriously. So the question becomes, what are they doing to respond to these concerns? First, our institutions have engaged in a dialogue nationally and with the attorneys generals of the different states to address concerns that have arisen. Those discussions have been ongoing, and our institutions will continue to play an active and engaged role in those discussions. Second, and most important, our institutions have not waited to fix problems that may in fact exist. Institutions have conducted internal evaluations of their own foreclosure procedures and have acted to make sure they comply with law. As reported, several institutions unilaterally and voluntarily suspended additional foreclosures while they were evaluating their processes to confirm they were compliant. In addition to the above, servicers have recognized the need to better communicate with their customers. All of the large services in our organization have taken steps to address customer concerns. For instance, again, Bank of America has taken 4 tangible steps to improve their customer service. First, they have dedicated approximately 30,000 associates nationwide to default servicing. Second, they have improved their transfer procedures and assigned case managers so that a borrower is talking to one person as much as possible. Third, they have refined the customer checklist so that those reviewing a file know where a particular loan is in the process. And finally, they are continuing to actively engage community agencies assisting those individuals facing foreclosure. This is just one servicer's efforts to improve their customer service, but these steps are reflected in many of our other servicers as well. In conclusion, I would say that foreclosure for our institution is a matter of last resort. Servicers will continue to actively work with their customers to find solutions to avoid foreclosure whenever possible. It is in the best interest of all parties involved. At the same time, they do so in a difficult and economic environment where there is no single solution for every struggling homeowner. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. And I think, what does the committee prefer to do? You want to ask questions of each?
Well, let's go through everybody first.
Hear everybody, and then we may have more questions after that. Angela.
Thank you very much, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Martin. I represent Economic Fairness Oregon, a nonprofit policy and advocacy group here in Oregon. Since 2007, I've had the opportunity to address committees of this legislature, most often this committee, on the topic of foreclosures and risky mortgage lending. Since that time, the depth and the breadth of the foreclosure crisis has certainly grown. If we look at last quarter results here in Oregon, we find that we logged the highest number of foreclosure starts to date, with nearly 9,000 Oregon homeowners starting the foreclosure process, which averages about 100 individuals per day last quarter. If we contrast this with the number of modifications that were offered last quarter nationally, and these are modifications offered both through the Federal Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP, and those offered through individual servicers, we find that in, September of this year, 2.9% of homeowners in default were under a modification program. The point I make by highlighting these numbers is that thus far our voluntary efforts have not kept up with the pace of foreclosures and are not meeting the needs and addressing the problems that we hear every time that we speak with individual homeowners. Again, when you speak to the foreclosure counselors, the legal aid attorneys, or homeowners, a few trends are undeniable and help explain why so few have been able to successfully navigate the loan modification process. Reports of lost paperwork, long delays, misinformation, and errors are repeated each time we interview homeowners. One of the more disturbing trends that we've noted lately are homeowners who default as a result of following instructions they have received from their servicer. Just one example I want to offer to that point. It's the story of Connie and Michael Umphress, homeowners who live in Northeast Portland and have had their mortgage for more than 10 years. It was about 1 year ago that they hit a rough patch. Story is very similar to many. Michael's hours had been cut, and they were slipping a few weeks behind on their mortgage payment, but they were not yet in default. In their mind, their solution was to call their servicer and match their due date with their paycheck date, and that would provide them the breathing room necessary to catch back up. When Michael called his mortgage servicer, which is Wells Fargo in this instance, he was informed that he could do more than just change the date when his mortgage was due. He had been automatically pre-qualified for a trial modification. According to instructions that he received from his servicer, he did not make the payment for that current month, and then the next month started making reduced payments. It wasn't long before they began receiving calls from the collections department, sometimes four a day, alerting them that they were in default and at risk of foreclosure. When they contacted the loss mitigation department, they were again assured that this was simply a formality. They were signed up for a trial modification. Their paperwork was being reviewed for a permanent modification. They could just go ahead and ignore these collection phone calls. After more than 8 months of making all of the trial payments on time, they received a letter notifying them that they had been officially put into the foreclosure process. Again, the loss mitigation department assured them that this was a formality and not to worry, they were in a trial modification. A month later, in September, 9 months after the trial period had started for them, they were denied permanent modification and told that their home would be sold unless they came up with $12,000, which was the difference between the reduced payment they were making and their regular payment. The emotional toll this has taken on the family has been significant, as I'm sure you can imagine. In their minds, they had done everything right and followed the instructions of their servicer, and yet now they were worse off than they had been when they first contacted their servicer 9 months ago. It's a very similar story that Susan Stoker was headed toward. She's a Washington County resident who had read about the Umphress' story on our website. She, too, was in danger of defaulting, but had not yet fallen behind. She'd actually just been laid off from a position she held with the state contracting board, and wanting to be proactive, contacted Wells Fargo to discuss her options for a loan modification. This is a mortgage that she has held for 12 years. She experienced the same frustrating process, which is now too common to anyone attempting to communicate with their loan servicer: lost paperwork, errors, and questionable advice. And speaking as someone who listened to well over an hour worth of tapes that she had logged, it was a frustrating process, to say the least. She was recently offered a temporary forbearance, allowing her to make reduced payments until she regains employment. Having read the Umphress' story, she did not want to sign on to an agreement without understanding all of the terms. What would her trial payments be? What would the penalties be that she would be accruing, and what would happen at the end of that trial period when she regained employment and was able to make a full payment? Questions that make her a pretty savvy consumer. Thus far, she has not been able to receive the information about the terms or the potential penalties she would face. And because she was not willing to agree to something that she didn't understand the terms of, her servicer assumes that she does not want the temporary forbearance. These are just two examples that highlight what has become painfully clear. The mortgage servicing industry is not serving the needs of homeowners or investors, and we all continue to pay the price as we wait for the housing market to recover. Thus far, the CARET approach has not kept pace with the demands, and we believe that there's an important role that state policy can and should be able to play to provide that extra nudge necessary to address the very real problems and restore a measure of accountability for property owners who depend on a system that is fair, transparent, and predictable. As we start this next session, I look forward to the opportunity to talk with you more specifically about what some of those nudges, what some of those changes could be so that we can help stop all preventable foreclosures from happening. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I know we've probably all heard from constituents who with similar stories. Next, we're going to go back to this way to Mr. Blackledge, and then we'll go back to Nania after Mr. Blackledge. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Blackledge. I have been a member of the Oregon State Bar since 1990, and I practice in Portland. My primary area of practice is debtor-creditor issues, real estate, and commercial transactions. A large part of my practice is real estate foreclosures, representation of creditors, and I handle a fair number of foreclosures, which are residential foreclosures of residential trust deeds. Although I'm a member of the debtor-creditor section in the bar, I'm not appearing before you today on behalf of the section or the bar. My comments are largely to try to give you some feedback on the bills that have passed regarding foreclosure issues, and I have conferred with a number of my colleagues who handle a large volume of residential home foreclosures to sort of take their temperature as far as what their concerns are, what they've been experiencing, and what they're seeing. And so I'm basically here to just mention a couple of those concerns and some suggestions that might be able to be addressed in this next session. The first is the form for the request for modification. There's some The statute requires that this request for modification form be included with the danger notice. The statute does not state what the request for modification form must contain. The forms that are being used are not consistent and include whatever particular information the beneficiary might believe is appropriate to determine whether the grantor or the trustee can qualify for a modification. Many of the beneficiaries and lenders would prefer that there be a recommended form in the statute so that there'll be some certainty and that the foreclosure, if it's the modification is denied, won't later be deemed, you know, insufficient or incorrect because of the request for modification form didn't have the proper information for them to, for the borrower to provide information. And so that's one of the issues that they would like to see is a uniform request form with minimum requirements that are dictated by the statute. The second aspect of the request for modification form that is of concern is the timing constraints that were in 628 and 310 in Section 1. That I'll just read it. It says, the beneficiary or beneficiary's agent, as soon as reasonably practical, but not later than 45 days after receiving the form, shall notify the grantor whether the beneficiary approves or denies or requires additional information. And then further, subsection D of that section basically provides that the trustee sale for the property may not occur until after the beneficiary or beneficiary's agent timely responds to the grantor. Well, the problem here is this is sort of set up to be denied because in many cases the information that is received by the beneficiary isn't sufficient for them to determine whether the grantor qualifies for a modification, and yet they have 45 days after receiving the request that they have to give an approval or a denial, or they can't hold the trustee's sale if it's ultimately denied, and so they're simply denying it if they don't have additional information. And I think the problem is that it says they notify them whether they approve or deny the request or require additional information. So if they require additional information, then they subsequently determine that the borrower doesn't qualify, then it's a huge problem because then they start the process all over again and there's more expense. So if the borrower ever does get into a situation where it might be able to cure the default or, you know, or refinance or something, they're not going to be able to do it because of the additional expense. In most cases, it's just set up to be denied by the wording of the statute. We are suggesting that this may be fixed by providing that the sale may be conducted at least 30 days after the denial notice is sent to the grantor, but no earlier than the original sale date scheduled in the trustee's notice of sale. Because in this way, the beneficiary may request additional information and receive it after the 45-day deadline. And if the modification is not approved, then the beneficiary may still conduct the sale after 30 days later. The next concern that was related to me is the affidavit of compliance. And that is now found under ORS 86.750 sub 5. Under the current statute, if no meeting is requested and the request for modification form is not returned, there is no requirement for an affidavit to be recorded that says anything. And there's no way for title companies to know whether the borrower requested a meeting or whether the modification request form was returned. So consequently, the title companies have been requiring trustees conducting sales to record an affidavit that says no request for modification was received within the time, you know, and no request for meeting, you know, even though the statute doesn't require it. So we're suggesting that the statute require an affidavit to state when the request for modification is not timely received, so that the title company will know that the foreclosure sale was properly conducted and that the trustee did what they needed to do. And part of the concern regarding this is that, you know, non-judicial foreclosures is a statutory procedure, and the trustees and lenders must follow that statute very strictly. And so they want some uniformity in the process. If the statute's vague or leaves a little to be, you know, up to the trustee or the lender, that makes it difficult and not as final. There's further confusion regarding the form of the affidavit of compliance. What form is it supposed to take? Currently, the affidavits of compliance are drafted on a case-by-case basis to show how the beneficiary or beneficiary's agent complied with the provisions of Section 3 of 628 and 3610. the beneficiaries want a uniform affidavit of compliance, where the beneficiary may simply check the box if and so that no drafting is required. This would streamline the process and make it more definite. The beneficiaries want to simplify the process and avoid any second guessing. I'm advised that California and Washington have already adopted check-the-box forms for this situation. So the affidavit could have a box to check to show that the borrower did not timely return the request for modification form, a box showing that the borrower did return it, but the beneficiary denied the request and provided, you know, the information that's required that was added in with 3610. And so there would be some definite form that could be relied on and not leave it up to, you know, the different lenders to up to their discretion, you know. There is some confusion also in the notice that to the borrower when they do not qualify. And currently, subsection 4 and section 1 of 3610 states that subsections 1 and 2 of this section do not apply to a beneficiary that determines in good faith, after considering the most current financial information the grantor provides, that the grantor is not eligible for a loan modification, provided that the beneficiary or beneficiary's agent notifies the grantor in writing that the grantor is not eligible. It's not clear whether that's the same notice that's provided for under Section 1C or what subsection 4's purpose is, you know, and so the beneficiaries aren't clear whether they need to comply with both subsections 1 and 4, or even though subsection 4 says 1 is not applicable, we think that needs to be looked at and at least clarified. The final thing that I wanted to mention here is that was related to me by my colleagues that I spoke with, was that mediating loan modifications just doesn't work. The truth is most lenders are willing to do deals if the borrowers have the ability to pay and qualify. And the biggest problem we're finding is that people do not currently have the ability to qualify for modifications. Many of them don't. And the other problem is that only about 5% of the borrowers return the modification request form. And of those, only about 1 to 2% may ultimately qualify for a modification. So, you know, there needs to be something, I guess, a little bit more to, you know, because the problem is that just the people don't have the money. I hope these comments will be useful to the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Very helpful. Thank you very much. And next we're going to hear from Nania Takrad. I hope I said your name correctly.
Oh, actually, Madam Chairwoman, it's Nanina Takla. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me here this morning. I am a member of the consumer section of the Oregon State Bar, but I'm here just to make comments individually based on my practice, which primarily deals with representing homeowners who are facing problems with their mortgage. Currently, I do that with the law office of Phil Goldsmith in Portland. I've been doing that for about 2 years now. I also have been representing homeowners in Pennsylvania prior to this, which is a judicial foreclosure state, so I have a perspective of how that process works versus a non-judicial. The two issues that I wanted to address this morning are the problems that homeowners are facing with loan modifications, and then just a couple comments about the MERS system. The vast majority of the people that we're seeing, and We get these all through referrals, either from advocacy organizations or from other attorneys. Law Office of Phil Goldsmith doesn't advertise in any way, but we are seeing plenty of people who are trying to get a loan modification and have become incredibly frustrated. There are a couple different types of problems that we've encountered. The one that I find the most disturbing are people who are engaged in this dual track. They have requested a loan modification. They've been working with the servicer for quite some time, sending in documents, being told the documents are either stale or lost, sending in more documents. In the meantime, they've gotten a notice of a foreclosure sale. They're becoming extremely frantic as the sale date approaches. They get told finally, okay, well, the sale date is, you know, don't worry, the sale's not going to happen. And then either the sale actually goes ahead and happens, or what's the sale date is postponed, but what the homeowner hears, whether that's what they were told or that's just what they processed, was that the sale was canceled. So they no longer track whether or not there's a pending foreclosure sale. They keep working with the loan modification, and before they get a decision either way, their property has been foreclosed on. Currently, we've seen and worked with at least 8 people in the last 9 months to whom this has happened, and these are people we've vetted and been able to confirm to a certain degree that they've probably would qualify for a loan modification, that they really were sending in their documents and trying to comply with the requirements, and in some cases were actively told by the servicers who are working with them on the modification that the sale wasn't going to happen, and yet the sale happened. Probably even more disturbingly, more than half of these were sales that were ultimately owned by Fannie Mae, which was one of the architects of the HAMP program, so I find that particularly distressing. I think one of the problems why people get confused about whether or not their sale has been canceled or whether it's still just been postponed is that the original notice that the people get, they get within 120 is at least 120 days before the first scheduled sale. And certainly I'm not criticizing that. I think the more notice people get, the better. But if that original sale date is put off, it can be extended up to an additional 180 days with just the notice being given on the courthouse steps and the homeowners themselves not getting any written notice. I think there's an assumption that because you get so much notice when the sale first happens, you know, people come to your door, they hand you papers, they post it on your door, that if there's another sale date scheduled, that you would, of course, get notice. So people aren't always as savvy, and additionally they're under complete stress at this point in time, but they don't think once they've been told a date the foreclosure sale isn't happening, they don't think to ask or ask and don't get correct information, well, does this mean that there's no foreclosure or does this mean you've just put off the sale? The other problem that we see are people, let me back up. The overarching problem that I see is lack of compliance with the existing guidelines for the loan modification programs. HAMP has an extensive list of, it's now contained in a handbook, but a extensive list of guidelines that servicers are to follow, and by and large, they are pretty good guidelines. They require notice to the borrowers. They require written notice if certain documents are missing. They require written notice if the loan is going to be, or the modification application is going to be closed because there hasn't been adequate follow-up. But I don't see that happening. I see a lot of cases where when I review what's been going on with the loan modification, multiple instances of the HAMP guidelines not being followed. And the frustration there is that the homeowners have no way to enforce or raise the issue of lack of compliance with HAMP as a way to press for reconsideration of the loan modification. I mean, they do under an informal advocacy process, but there's no legal right for those homeowners, no way for them to push other than going through the established escalation procedure, which some people have success with, but the people I see don't have success with that. I also see as the committee is probably aware, under HAMP, which is what the vast majority of the loan modifications or attempts for loan modifications that I see, it's set up so that if you are approved, initially what you get is a temporary loan modification. And the idea is that you make three payments under this temporary loan modification as a way to sort of assure the servicer and the investor that this is indeed a modification that's affordable and that you will be able to sustain. And then you're supposed to get a permanent modification. I see people, as Ms. Martin referred to, people who get stuck on that temporary track for ages well beyond the 3 months, and then sometimes get denied after that's happened. If you look at the HAMP guidelines, all the qualifications for becoming, all the qualifications that you're supposed to meet, the borrower is supposed to be vetted at the time that they get the temporary mod, and the only reason why they would be denied after they get the temporary mod would be to failure make the payments or some significant change in income. But that's not what I'm seeing with people who get denied, even who have been in the temporary mod. There's also a frustration in that the temporary modification that they receive just gives them a monthly payment. It doesn't explain how that loan is going to be modified. I have a client who made it through the process, got the temporary loan modification. He didn't completely agree with the arrears that were showing because he believed that he wasn't as far behind. As it turns out, I think some of his confusion stemmed from the way that his payments had been accounted for, but he legitimately was worried that the loan modification was incorrect. So he made the payments, but he attempted to get clarification of what were these terms of this temporary modification. Because he didn't send in the modification signed, which again under HAMP is not a requirement under the latest guidelines, they decided that he was not in compliance with the temporary mod and went ahead and foreclosed on his home. He doesn't have the property right now. We're trying to get it back for him, but I don't know if it's going to be successful. One other thing that struck me in terms of the existing statute that I believe could be a relatively easy issue to address is under the Oregon statutes, the cap on attorney fees and costs of the foreclosure, if a person is going to cure before foreclosure, is $1,000 for attorney fees, costs of the process. It's not clear whether that applies to loan modifications. A loan modification is not a cure, but if somebody gets a loan modification, in addition to all the other fees and interest that they might end up paying, it appears that there's not necessarily a cap on the attorney fees and costs that they would have to pay. Finally, I just wanted to make a couple comments about MERS. In the 5 years plus that I've had working with homeowners and homeowner advocates in two states, I have never heard of a consumer who knew that there was an 800 number or a website that they could use to look up the servicer or investor in their loan. I certainly wasn't aware that this information was publicly available. And in terms of, there's two pieces of information that MERS holds. Who the servicer is not as valuable. There's other ways for the consumer to get that information. I believe that particular piece of information has been well covered by federal legislation. If the servicer changes, both the old servicer and the new servicer are required to send notices to the homeowners. The issue of where to send the payments is really not something that homeowners encounter. Who the investor is, and that can matter sometimes when the reason for denial of your modification is that it's against investor guidelines, or there are other reasons why you might want to know who owns your loan. That information is incredibly difficult to track, especially when MERS is involved. And then just one final comment, simply as a taxpayer and citizen of the state, essentially what MERS does is it allows the mortgage companies and lenders to avoid paying recording fees every time they transfer the deed of trust. That's a source of revenue for the counties and for the state. There have been significant savings. This is complete and utter hearsay, but I believe it. And that's, MERS has been able to save over $1 billion in recording fees during the course of its existence. When I buy a home, I have to pay for the recording fees. The fact that this is used as a convenient instrument to avoid paying the fees, I find problematic. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Finally, Mr. Dubanowicz, thank you for your patience.
Good morning, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Keith Dubanowicz. I am Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to Attorney General Kroger. What I'd like to do this morning is to review some of the facts that are facing us in this foreclosure crisis, describe what your Department of Justice has done to respond to the foreclosure crisis, and describe some of the cases that we are handling in our Criminal Justice Division and that are being handled by our Consumer Protection Unit. In 2008, the year before this legislative session began, there were 21,900 homes in foreclosure. So far this year, there are 39,408 homes in foreclosure in Oregon. That's almost double in the course of 2 years. In early 2008 and 2009, many of the properties that were going into foreclosure were properties secured by esoteric mortgages, negative amortization loans, interest-only loans, and 0% down kind of loans. Most of those loans have now been processed through the system, and the loans that are going into foreclosure today are pretty standard 30-year mortgage loans. And they're going into foreclosure because of our high unemployment rate. Now, our unemployment rate and the impact that that has on our borrowers has been aggravated by a number of factors, and probably the most significant of which is the substantial drop in home values. That has caused those homes to go underwater, meaning that the value of the home is less than what is owed on the home. And that's complicated things because many of the loan modification programs are hinged upon the net asset value of the property. And the reality is that if you're a homeowner and you owe substantially more than your property is worth, your motivation for staying in your home is quite different. Now, to protect Oregon homeowners from predatory mortgage relief scams and unscrupulous loan modification practices, this legislature passed laws in 2008 and 2009 regulating companies that are involved in foreclosure counseling and loan modification services. House Bills 3630 and 2191 prohibit the charging of advance fees, require extensive disclosures, and require loan modification and foreclosure counseling companies to register with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Those two bills have been quite successful. We have been able to work closely with DCBS and close down a number of these loan mod companies that have been requiring substantial upfront fees but not providing any services in response to those fees. So those two bills were, frankly, substantial improvements in Oregon law. I'd like to turn to now what your Department of Justice has done in response to the foreclosure crisis. Shortly after his election in 2008, Attorney General Kroger asked me to join his staff as special counsel, and he tasked me with studying the foreclosure crisis and requested that I develop an action plan for Department of Justice enforcement and to work with the legislature on developing ideas for ways that we can protect Oregon homeowners. I was fortunate to learn a lot from DCBS Director Streisinger, who unfortunately will be leaving us, and many members of the legislature, but particularly including Chair Bonamici, and I'd like to express my appreciation to both of them for helping me. In the 2009 legislative session, we worked closely with you to pass Senate Bill 628, which provides homeowners a better opportunity to avoid foreclosure. That was amended earlier this year by House Bill 3610, which requires the servicer to provide additional information to the homeowner prior to the foreclosure sale. While these are significant legislative accomplishments, we still have a substantial foreclosure problem. On the enforcement front, when Attorney General Kroger took office in 2009, the Department of Justice had no attorneys dedicated to mortgage fraud. That year, we obtained a federal grant to fund a new program to prosecute mortgage fraud, and that grant funds a prosecutor and an investigator. And it has allowed our department to expand our efforts, open more cases, and protect more homeowners in the state. Since its creation, our mortgage fraud task force has opened more than three dozen mortgage fraud cases and foreclosure scam investigations. We've reached more than a dozen legal settlements that have included restitution for Oregon homeowners, and we have banned a number of unscrupulous companies from ever doing business in our state. Earlier this year, the primary consumer protection law, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, did not apply to loans and lending. As a consequence, lawyers in our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Unit were quite hampered in being able to do anything to address the foreclosure crisis. However, since the passage of House Bill 3706, our Consumer Protection Unit has been quite active in the foreclosure fraud area, as I will describe in a minute. We have also greatly expanded our consumer education and outreach efforts. For example, we've worked closely with DCBS and Oregon Housing and Community Services to sponsor home ownership preservation events, which bring together in one place servicers and homeowners so that they can renegotiate the terms of their loan. Finally, we have a call center which is staffed with volunteers, and it provides a free, prompt, and effective service to Oregon homeowners facing foreclosure. I'd like to now turn to the type of work that our Criminal Justice Division is doing. We have approximately 40 open cases, and these cases are troubling in many ways. For example, organized crime is frankly quite active in Oregon in the foreclosure area. We've seen a number of criminal organizations using shell limited liability corporations and individuals as straw buyers. And what they do is they constantly transfer a steady pool of homes, an asset pool, within the organization through the mortgage process. The organization falsely creates the impression of an arm's length transaction in order to create a constant pool of capital, which we call the capital pool, and that capital is the mortgage loans. The victims in this are our banks, because these frauds occur regardless of bad real estate markets, because in the bad market you use a short sale, and in the up market they flip the properties and continue to pursue the fraud. What happens is the capital pool is laundered within the organization using multiple bank accounts from shell entities, and often what are quite legitimate banks fail to recognize their status as a victim, even though they have in place what appear to be appropriate internal processes. And these same banks become victims time and time again. This fraudulent mortgage activity has greatly warped the real estate market in numerous Oregon communities. These are our most complex and largest cases that we handle. We also find a number of equity skimming and lease buyback schemes. In these schemes, a bank issues a mortgage based on an individual representation to the bank that they're engaged in an arm's length transaction. The individual holds out a buyer for a higher price when in fact the buyer is a straw buyer. The individual fraudster skims the enhanced value as new equity, takes it out of the property, and then disappears. Sometimes this type of fraud is coupled with a foreclosure fraud, whereby the fraudster tricks the homeowner into believing that they're actually going to go in foreclosure, but the way to save their home is to transfer their legal interests in the form of a deed to the fraudster, who strips the property in exchange for a lease buyback and takes the equity and disappears. We also see a number of fraudulent reconveyances, and in this kind of scheme, the fraudster has the owner convey the property to the fraudster via deed. The fraudster then sends a demand to the mortgage holder with a default provision whereby the legal interests revert to the fraudster free and clear if there's no satisfactory response. And of course, the legitimate holder has no understanding of what's going on and may not timely respond, and then the property reconveys free and clear to the fraudster, and they disappear with the money. We continue to see fraudulent applications, and these unfortunately show up frequently after the home is in foreclosure. And these fraudulent applications are people who misrepresent their income, their net worth, whether they're using their home as a primary residence, and a variety of other things. Unfortunately, lenders continue to fail to do appropriate due diligence, and as a consequence, they continue to generate high-risk loans that go into default. Our consumer protection section, as you know, receives thousands of consumer complaints on a wide variety of issues. It is fair to say, however, that complaints about foreclosure activities have skyrocketed. They are up 36% when you compare 2009 to 2010, and we're not even done with 2010 yet. What I'd like to do is give you some examples of some of the complaints that we're receiving, and we can discuss them if you have any questions later. In the loan modification area, we continually hear people complaining about lost paperwork. I sent them material, they lost it, I sent it again, they lost it, and I sent it again. We receive a number of complaints about confusing, conflicting, and improper instructions from the lenders. For example, the lender tells the homeowner to stop making payments so that they qualify for a loan modification. A number of consumers are simply unclear on whether they're in or out of a loan modification program. They just don't know. And it's frequently unclear whether they actually qualify or not because they do not get clear communication from the servicer. We, like the lady that spoke before me, have seen a number of people who experience substantial delay. And under the most loan modification programs, if you qualify for a trial modification and meet the criteria and satisfy the criteria during the trial period, you should convert to a permanent modification in the course usually of 3 months. We found a number of cases where people seem to be in a permanent trial modification. And that is frustrating for the homeowner because they simply don't know, are they on the verge of foreclosure or not. We've also seen a number of cases of improper foreclosure. And this occurs when somebody is in the process of either requesting a loan modification or in a trial modification itself. We've seen a couple of instances of lack of proper notice of foreclosure. We've seen examples of payments that have been misapplied, and we've seen a few examples of lack or failure to comply with Senate Bill 628 and House Bill 3610. Let me give you some specific examples. A homeowner in Salem received multiple past due notices for her mortgage, but she has never missed a single payment. A homeowner in Madras said that he was out of town when his home was foreclosed on, and he found out that it was foreclosed when he got home and there was a note taped to the door by Fannie Mae. Welcome home from your vacation. A homeowner in Milwaukee said that he was supposed to get modification paperwork because there was a sale set on June 17. He called and said, I haven't gotten the paperwork yet. And they said that they would delay the foreclosure by 30 days. The paperwork didn't come. The consumer called the servicer 2 weeks later, and the servicer said, geez, we're backed up. We'll send the paperwork soon, but they were not willing to extend the foreclosure date again. And sure enough, he did not get the application materials for a loan modification until after the foreclosure date. A consumer in Milwaukee said that she was trying to get a loan modification for over a year. She finally received a phone call stating that she was approved. But a few weeks later, guess what? She got another telephone call that said the guidelines had changed and she was no longer approved for a loan modification. And a homeowner in Portland said that she was instructed to skip her September and October payments and then start paying a modified payment in November. In November, she got a collection call from the servicer who said, well, you were given the wrong information and you now have to make up for all of the past due payments that you didn't make, as well as interest and penalties on that. And she doesn't know if she's going to go into foreclosure now or not. These are some of the typical examples of problems that we're receiving here in our consumer protection section. Earlier this year, you heard a number of concerns about robocalling, and there is indeed a 50-state investigation into that. But before I get to that, what we did is we immediately sent out letters to the top 12 lenders and trustees in the state. And we wanted them to explain to us how they are complying with Senate Bill 628 and how they're complying with Oregon foreclosure laws, and we want to see what their compliance protocol is. We are currently in discussions with these lenders and trustees, and we are examining their responses. As you've heard, there are a number of loan modification programs in place. There is not any state law that requires any lender to modify any home loan. It's a contractual agreement, and it's up to them on whether they want to modify a loan or not. The largest loan modification program is HAMP, Home Affordable Modification Program, and generally participation in that program is voluntary unless the lender, the financial institution, received TARP funds. If a servicer is in HAMP, and if a borrower meets a certain eligibility criteria, participating servicers have to run a test known as a net present value. And that's something I mentioned to you earlier that is substantially impacted by whether the home is underwater or not. That test evaluates whether a foreclosure or a loan modification would yield a higher value. If the value of the modified mortgage is greater, then the servicer must offer the borrower a modification. Now, because HAMP is a federal program and we do not have ready access to servicer information, we are frankly unable to determine very easily whether servicers are complying with the HAMP modification requirements. Now, interesting timing, the Congressional Oversight Panel issued a report this morning that concluded that the HAMP program had not met its goals in part because of the lack of accountability. And so that's one area that the legislature may want to look into is what can Oregon do to ensure that HAMP is being complied with here in Oregon. The 50-state investigation has been referenced earlier, and essentially what happened is that all 50 states, attorneys general, joined forces to investigate initially what was referred to as robo-signing and allegations that affidavits filed in support of foreclosure were being filed falsely. First, please note that that Oregon is a non-judicial foreclosure state, which means that the type of affidavits that are filed in most other states are simply not filed in a court of record here. And indeed, it is very rare that a judge in the state of Oregon ever approves a foreclosure. So the significance of a false affidavit in another state is more profound than it is here in Oregon. Possibly as a consequence, we don't seem to have a lot in common with complaints about robo-signing that have taken place in other states. What we have noticed is problems with affidavits that are required by Senate Bill 628 and House Bill 3610, and that has to do with borrowers who are not returning loan modification request forms because they're already in a loan modification program. The trustee or someone at the servicer says in the foreclosure affidavit that they never received a loan modification form or a loan modification request, and thereafter the lender proceeds with foreclosure even though the homeowner is actually in a loan modification program. Because our foreclosure crisis is far from coming to an end, we will continue to see fraudsters and scammers working in this area. The good news is that pure foreclosure, consultant, and loan modification scams seem to be on the decline. The bad news is that mortgage and principal reduction scams appear to be on the rise. We will continue to work with the legislature as strongly as we can, and I thank you for your time and attention. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you so much. Well, we have five people here who have testified and probably a few questions. Senator Girard?
Thank you. Keith, this question is kind of for you and maybe for Kevin a little bit. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Now, if we didn't learn anything from this collapse of the banking industry, it's the bundling of the loans and the risk that's taken with those bundles. If you look at Washington Mutual, they invested heavily in subprime loans. Now, is there any? I understand that federal law and state law in the governance of these banks, but is there anything that we can do to shore up the fiduciary responsibilities that banks have in this state so that, you know, if you use the Washington Mutual example, that just can't occur? Because that's what precipitated the whole mess. And, it's nice for the community to sit here and say, geez, we want to help everybody. But the testimony is very clear is they just don't have the financial resources to get themselves out of foreclosure in the vast majority of the cases. So what can we do, A, to prevent anything more from happening? And then what can we do? I'm fully supportive of trying to help all these people that are in foreclosure as best we can, but I don't see anything that other than letting the free market just take its time and then starting over. But
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, unfortunately, there's not an easy answer to your difficult question. The financial institutions are on a bit of a horns of a dilemma. We want them to loan money. And for many years, they were encouraged to expand their lending pool. So they make money by lending money, but it's also good for our communities when people have a home that they can settle down in. The securitization of those loans facilitated the ability of lending institutions to loan more money. So in one way, we want them to securitize loans and be able to pass on the debt so that they have more money in their pool so that they can lend to their communities. On the other side of the coin, the reality is that not everybody does qualify to buy a home. And that is the dilemma that financial institutions face. As I sit here, I don't have an easy solution for you or the legislature on how we can avoid this problem going forward. Hopefully we learn from our mistakes and don't repeat them.
If I could follow up that question that Senator Girard asked, what can we do to make the loan writer more accountable for the consequences? Because a lot of what happened was because they were disengaged with the consequences, so they could do whatever they want and somebody else down the road paid the price.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Burdick, I can give you an example of what we're doing in the Department of Justice. The Public Employees Retirement Fund invests millions and millions of dollars in a lot of different corporations. And over the course of the last couple of years, they, like many of the rest of us, have lost millions of dollars. Well, I haven't lost millions of dollars, but
billions.
They've lost dollars on their investments. So what is taking place is institutions like PERS are bringing class action securities cases against the financial institutions that didn't have appropriate underwriting criteria. The classic example is Countrywide. There are a number of cases that have been brought against Countrywide, both for the way they underwrote, or I'm sorry, the kind of loans that they allowed to be made under their name, but also then in the securitization process where those loans were then packaged up and sold off as mortgage-backed securities. There are a number of investors who have bought claims under the mortgage-backed securities with the belief that they were all AAA-rated loans. But when you call down and look at the loans themselves, they really weren't AAA rated. There were a lot of problem loans, and as a consequence, those mortgage-backed securities are not performing, and they're not worth what they used to be. So that's one way that institutional investors across the country have taken action against the people who are responsible for having given out too much money in the lending process.
That's helpful. The other question I have is several of you have said, given instances of people who were advised to stop making their payments. That was extremely troubling to me. Was this over the phone? Do they have anything in writing in these cases?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Burdick, we're not aware of anyone having written down that you should not pay. And it's commonly an over-the-phone kind of representation that a homeowner relies upon. They don't know any better that they shouldn't rely upon that. But we sure would be interested in if anybody has written representation that they shouldn't pay, I would strongly encourage them to report it to the Department of Justice.
Well, I'm just wondering if one of the things we should consider is requiring written notification for something like that. And now the real chair is back.
Thank you. Excuse me. I had to take care of several issues. I'm sorry if somebody already asked my questions. I hope.
I think Kevin had a chance.
I wanted Kevin to respond to what I asked.
Oh. Chair Bonamici, Senator Girod, I don't have a response in terms of what specifically can be done. I know that there are ongoing discussions. I think specifically this last November committee hearings that took place, different groups have come forward with different proposals. Candidly, I don't know what the answer is. I think the earlier testimony today was that a lot of the some of the questionable subprime loans have kind of worked their way through the system now, and you're in a situation where some of these others are, it's more of a payment-related situation. So I really don't know the answer.
And just to follow up on that, Kevin, I just want to reiterate, the secondary market is just about as dirty as I think the history has ever seen for investments, the oversight of those investments, and everything else. And I just really think that the banking industry needs to step up to the plate and clean up the secondary market. Now, I don't know how you do it. I think it has to be done with federal law, not state law. But it is really something that I think this whole calamity starts with the secondary market. Personally, I don't see anything wrong with a subprime loan because it allowed people that couldn't afford loans to buy into houses. But the bundling of those loans and then the risk being concentrated in one big lump sum, and then banks buying that, thinking that they're going to make 9 or 10% off that money, that's where it all started. So the secondary market, in my opinion, is where all the problems are. And I think it would behoove the banking institutions to try to clean up the secondary markets.
Thank you. I don't know if I had a question mark at the end.
No,
if you wanted to respond.
That was just my own personal opinion.
Okay. Not a question, a comment. Okay, I have a few questions, Mr. Christensen. I know that you and I talked a little bit about the exemption in Senate Bill 628, and I know Mr. Blackledge raised this as well. If both of you want to address the issue of how many of the institutions are looking at that language and just saying, well, we don't need to send the notice to the consumer because we already processed a modification request from them, or is it more that it takes more time to figure that out, that they're just giving the notice to everyone? What's your sense on that exemption language that Mr. Blackledge mentioned and you and I previously discussed?
Chair Bonamici, it's my understanding from some of the communications I have that our bankers with the institution in particular complying with 628. And as far as specific why they're not, I don't have a case-by-case breakdown or a bank-by-bank breakdown why they may or may not be. So I'm not sure. Yeah, I can get back to you on that and see if I can give you a little more
I would appreciate
detail.
That. And it isn't a compliance issue. It's the use of the exemption language. Do you happen to know, Mr. Blackman?
The use of the exemption, I'm sorry. I'm not.
There's some language in Senate Bill 628 which you mentioned that said that if there has been a determination prior that the borrower does not qualify, then they don't need to give the notice. So I'm just curious about how often that's being used.
Chair Bonamici, I'm not sure that I said it, or if I said it that way, I'm not sure about that. I do know from the people that I have spoken with that is an area of confusion where there has been a modification in process before the foreclosure has commenced, and then the request form has been sent out with the danger notice, that many of the borrowers aren't returning the request for modification form because they think they already have one, being processed. I believe, though, that at least the trustees that I've spoken with are going ahead and sending that request for modification form out when they do commence the foreclosure. In fact, many of the trustees, especially some of the out-of-state trustees, are sending a request for modification form to absolutely everyone. I receive them when I'm the attorney representing a judgment creditor that may have a lien against the property. They send me a request for modification form. That just increases the mailing costs for everybody, and ultimately the borrower. But I'm not sure that any of them think that they're exempt if there's a modification already pending.
Thank you. It would be helpful to receive that information, and also be very helpful, Mr. Blackledge, if you have your comments in writing or could email those, that would be very helpful. I don't know if you submitted something in writing. Yes, Senator Dredd.
Mr. Blackledge, the question I have is, of all the people that you have come to your office, how many have positive equity in these foreclosures? Because right now, everybody, I got to tell you, most people that have 80% loans have negative equity. And that seems to be one of the major problems or stumbling blocks.
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, most don't have equity in their properties in this economic climate. I handle all sorts of foreclosures, and of the residential foreclosures I handle, there's just a whole myriad of problems that lead up to why they're in foreclosure. But largely, when you actually look at it, there's no equity in the property, or it's
I had a question for Keith about the what you described as equity skimming and leaseback. Is that something that's covered by the foreclosure consultant, the House Bill 3630 from 2008, or is there a gap somewhere that isn't covering that situation you raised?
Chair Bonamici, it is covered by that, but we're pursuing those actions as criminal.
Right. When you said organized crime, I think everybody woke up. Keith, you said that the Department of Justice sent letters to the top lenders about how they're complying with 628, and you're examining the responses. Did all the recipients respond?
Chair Bonamici, we have not received written responses from all of the recipients of our letters.
Thank you. And I assume you're pursuing that.
Chair Bonamici, you're correct. We are definitely pursuing it. It is our intent
Mr. Christensen
to ensure
is writing
compliance
that.
With Oregon law.
Thank you. And I have a question for Nanina, who's outside of the microphone range at the moment. You mentioned the issue of the loss of revenue to counties because of the electronic registration. I've heard that issue. In fact, I have a letter from someone, an attorney in
somewhere in southern Oregon who's very concerned about that. But then when I ask other people about it, they say, well, it doesn't need to be recorded if it's just a transfer of ownership. If it's just a transfer of the note, there only needs to be a recording if there's a transfer of ownership. So can somebody clarify this issue? Because I think the League of Counties would be sitting here wondering what's going on if in fact they're losing millions of dollars of revenue.
I can address it a little bit. I think maybe Mr. Blackledge would also know. The transfer of ownership of the note doesn't need to be recorded, but transfer of the ownership of the deed of trust needs to be recorded. And my understanding from Black Letter Law is that the deed of trust and the note are supposed to be always transferred together. Also, the foreclosure statute says that before the trustee can bring the foreclosure, all the assignments of transfers have to be recorded. So that's where my understanding would be when the deed of trust and note are transferred through the several different entities as part of the securitization. In the olden days, each one of those assignments of the deed of trust would have to be recorded in the recorder's office, and you know, because this takes place so quickly, obviously sometimes, you know, four or five transactions in a day, it was just deemed to be not practical. But maybe Mr. Blackledge knows more about that.
Chair Bonamici, what Ms. Dacla says is correct. And in fact, I believe there's case law that says that the transfer of the security without a transfer of the payment obligation is a nullity. And so it's always kind of amused me, the MERS issue, and that it's a nominee for the actual lender who holds the note, and it's purporting to hold the security, the trust deed. And so when I have been presented with a MERS trust deed, I have always insisted that MERS assign to the lender so that I would have the entity that holds the note and the security interest together, so I could make sure that the foreclosure was properly done.
Okay, just to make sure that this is clear. It's not the transfer of the note that needs to be recorded, it's a transfer of the deed of trust, but when they're transferred, they should be transferred together or they could be a nullity. Am I correct on that?
Chair Bonamici, yes, you are correct. And in fact, many of the assignments of trust deed state in them that they not only assign the beneficiary's interest under the trust deed, but they also assign the promissory note and the rights to receive the payments and sums due under the note. And it's correct that the assignment of the trust deed, all assignments of the trust deed, must be recorded in the county before a nonjudicial foreclosure may be commenced. And so, therefore, you would expect that the beneficiary holding that trust deed also would hold the note.
Senator, if I could just follow up on that, because it took me quite a while to grasp this conceptually, so I'd like to share.
Maybe we could draw a picture.
But the two instruments do separate things. The note is your promise to pay the person who lends you money, and the deed of trust is the instrument that gives the lender some security, essentially that if you don't pay, they can take the property. So the deed of trust is an interest in property, and that's why it needs to be recorded, because traditionally all interests in property are recorded at the county recorder's office. So that's why one needs to be recorded and one doesn't.
Thank you. Fascinating. Just a couple more questions, and I know we have still have some more topics to cover. I wanted to ask Kevin Christensen about the an issue that I apologize, just learned about today, and it's force-placed insurance, and it's my understanding that what's happening in some instances, and this is actually from an American Banker publication, what happens sometimes when the bank suspects or hears that the borrower's insurance policy has lapsed.
they purchase insurance to cover the property, and my concern about this is my understanding that in some instances either the borrower has insurance in place and it's a mistake, the insurance costs significantly more than what the borrower paid or would have paid. And there's also a fee that goes to the servicer for purchasing that insurance. So do you know anything about this practice? And I apologize, I don't have more of an understanding about it, but it's a November 10th article in the American Banker about how this is placing additional costs on both the homeowner and the investor when these policies are purchased, and they can be up to 10 times as costly as a regular policy.
Senator Bonamici, I'm not familiar with the issue. I presume that it probably stems from a situation in which the documents require insurance to be maintained on the property. Mm-hmm. That's only a guess. I want to look into the issue more so I can provide a little more clarity to you.
Terrific. I would appreciate that. And if anybody has insight on that, if we could get some information about, Mr. Blackledge says, about what's happening in specifically in Oregon about that practice, that would be helpful.
Chair Bonamici, I could offer you something on that. ORS 746.205 has an insurance warning that has to be included in all trust deeds that basically states that if the borrower lets the insurance lapse, that the lender can force place insurance and that it may be more expensive. And at any rate, that may be helpful to you. As far as the policies costing 10 times more, I'm not aware of that, but there is a provision that to give the borrower notice that if their insurance lapses, and in many cases I know that and I think the notice even says that if the borrower then gets insurance, that the lender will cancel the more expensive insurance that it has.
Okay. That would be useful to look at. I'll look at that, and there's probably, I see Lou from the DCBS back there, probably rules about how that can be handled.
I'm sure there are.
Well, Senator Bonamici, just quickly, I have seen problems with force-placed insurance. In some instances, the homeowner does have insurance and has trouble getting the proof to the servicer. This issue is handled pretty much exclusively by servicers, and they have, because of the volume of the work they do and other issues, they tend to have problems always accurately processing the paperwork they receive. One other thing is, while it might not necessarily cost 10 times as much, often the force-placed insurer is a subsidiary of the servicer or has some sort of financial relationship with the servicer, so there's an incentive, obviously, for the servicer to force-place insurance. Also, the value of the insurance is based off the property value. If the appraisal was inflated, that could be a problem. I saw a case once where there was a misplacement of a decimal point, so property was insured for $1 million, whereas it was nowhere close to that value, and it was quite a significant jump in premium there.
I can imagine. Are there other questions? Anyone else have any questions? Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and I would, Mr. Blackledge, appreciate getting those in writing. I was madly taking notes, but I'm afraid I might have missed it.
I submitted written testimony.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
So that's what's happening now.
What's that?
No, I was wondering if this was the new paperless environment that we need.
And the paperless.
Get this written testimony.
Thank you so much. Our next panel, we'll get an update on. We separated out the issue of tenants in foreclosure. Sybil is here. Sybil Hebb, and also Pat Wade, attorney with Hirshner Hunter and a member of the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Section, and Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center will give us an update on foreclosure as it affects tenants and some of the legislation that we've passed and are considering for the next session on that issue. Welcome, and thanks for sitting through the whole morning.
Go ahead.
Thank,
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and we appreciate the opportunity here to talk a little bit about sort of an additional issue related to the foreclosure crisis, which is what happens to tenants who are legitimate tenants paying their rent in homes that are owned by landlords who are losing those homes in foreclosure. And we want to just give you a little bit of an update on what we're working on in preparation for next session. As you may remember, this legislature in 2009 passed some initial legislation in the form of Senate Bill 952 and a companion bill, House Bill 3004, that provided some basic protections for tenants in those circumstances by saying that they were entitled to notice of the foreclosure process. So when the homeowner gets a notice posted on his door, the tenant gets that notice as well, so that they have some indication that the home is in crisis and maybe their status may be in jeopardy. And that notice is required to give them a little bit of information about what their rights might be post-foreclosure. And this legislature passed protection that said that tenants were entitled to either 30 days notice prior to eviction after a foreclosure sale by the new owner, or 60 days notice if they were living in a fixed-term tenancy that had a long-term lease. And soon after that happened, the federal law, or about the same time, actually, the federal Congress passed a protection that provided greater protection for tenants in some ways and didn't address some of the issues that Oregon law addressed. The greater protection that the federal law provided was that tenants were entitled to at least 90 days notice post the foreclosure sale, or the full length of their fixed-term lease if they had a fixed-term tenancy. The federal law didn't address whether the tenants were to get advance notice of the foreclosure sale. The federal law also didn't do two other things that our state law did. Our state law provided that after a tenant got notice of a foreclosure sale, they had the right to apply their security deposit or any prepaid rent against rent that was owing in the future to the landlord. And this was done because often landlords who lose their homes in foreclosure are not able to or available to be found to request the payback of a security deposit that they might owe to that tenant. And so a way to sort of protect the tenant from losing that money was to say during the pendency of the foreclosure sale, once they have that notice, they have the right to apply those prepaid dollars towards their currently owing rent, and the federal law does not speak to that issue at all. The other issue that the federal law didn't really address was whether or not the new purchaser at the foreclosure sale becomes a landlord. And the state law took specific steps to address exactly when the new purchaser would become a landlord and step into the shoes of a landlord and when they would not. And that was something that has provided a little bit of clarity around those relationships. Because the federal law passed and provided greater protection, we are now in a situation in which the state law is inconsistent with the federal law. That's created some confusion. There are aspects of the federal law that are far more protective of tenants, and so we would like to adopt those provisions into Oregon law and require that, consistent with federal law, tenants have at least 90 days notice post the foreclosure sale, or that they may stay in their leases for the full extent of their fixed-term tenancy. The new purchaser at that point would have the right to accept rent or to require rent, or may choose not to if they prefer to avoid having any of the responsibilities of being a landlord. And that that choice in the purchaser's hands would remain in our concept. That's under current law. We would keep that concept in our proposal. So the major change that we'd like to make is to incorporate the new federal notice standards into Oregon state law. We also would like to remove a requirement that was passed in Oregon law and doesn't exist and is not allowed under federal law, which is that under Oregon law, we said that a tenant is not entitled to any protection at all unless they respond to a notice within a certain time period providing certain forms of written evidence about the status of their tenancy. And we've seen that be a barrier to tenants, and they have gotten confused about it or gotten it wrong. It's also something that's not required under the federal law and so is inconsistent, and we'd like to remove that consistency. I should stop here and say that throughout this process, we've been working to meet with the interested parties to let them know what our list of issues is and explain to them what our concerns are and seek their feedback and input. This summer, we started meeting with some of the interested parties, and we had a meeting with many members of the United Financial Lobby in August, and have also been meeting with members of the debtor-creditor section and just generally trying to get as much input as we can. And one of the pieces of feedback that we got was that lenders or new purchasers really want to know what the information is about the tenant's residency or tenancy. And what we've done in listening to that feedback is say that we will provide several places where the tenant is given information about how they can get that information to the lender, and we've also provided some protections against the lender having to pay any attorney's fees if they lose a case because the tenant didn't provide information after being given sufficient notice and information about where they can find that information. So that's just one of the pieces that we've tried to address and update as we've moved along. I know you're short on time. I would say quickly that the other sort of key pieces that we're concerned about are, one is there's nothing in current Oregon law or federal law that requires any information that by the new purchaser to the tenant to let the tenant know that the sale has taken place, there has been a change in ownership, and who the new owner is. And as you heard, homeowners are often very confused about when the foreclosure sale is going to take place. It often gets moved and changed around. Tenants don't get that information. We're not suggesting that they need to get informed every single time the foreclosure sale date changes, but we do think it's really important that when the home has been sold, the tenant gets some information letting them know that so that they understand what their new status is and who their new, responsible party is. And so we've proposed that there be a change in ownership notice that gives the tenant that information, also reiterates what their rights are to notice prior to eviction under federal law, and again provides the tenant with information about where they can send the new owner evidence of what the status of their rental agreement is. The other key piece that we're concerned about is some form of enforcement. Neither state nor federal law right now contain any enforcement mechanisms. And unfortunately, we have continued to see clients coming into our offices who have not gotten notice, who have been given inappropriate notice, and who have, as a result, suffered great housing instability or the loss of housing as a result. And the purpose of the law, both federal and state, is to provide some stability for tenants who are good paying tenants, who've been paying their rent, and through no fault of their own are suffering this instability. We want to make sure that the law is complied with. So we have a proposal that is sort of twofold. One is to provide some reasonable sanctions for knowing violations. The other is to make some technical, sort of practical amendments to the way that the FED eviction process works so that the forms are amended and it is easier for a lender or a new purchaser who's going through an eviction process to check the form and identify that it is an eviction that's taking place as a result of a foreclosure against a homeowner who was renting the home to a tenant. That gives the judge a better ability to identify what the laws are that would apply. It gives the tenants a little bit more information about what their rights are, again, and it just generally helps to inform the process. So there's sort of practical enforcement issues that we're hoping to address, as well as statutory violations, penalties for violation. The rest of the proposals that we have are fairly technical fixes. In conversation with certain members of the debtor-creditor section, there have been suggestions that we reword certain things, that we've tried to address those where we could. The only other piece that I think it's worth noting and that we haven't yet talked to this committee about is that after a foreclosure sale has happened and there is a new purchaser, a new owner of the home, we don't propose to change the fact that the purchaser has the ability to choose whether or not to be a landlord or not. And we're not proposing to change the structure around which they could make that decision. But we do think that even if they choose not to be a landlord, there are a couple of provisions of the Landlord-Tenant Act that make sense to apply, and that's for the protection of both parties. An example of that is the abandoned property statute, which exists in Chapter 90, which is the Landlord-Tenant Act, and also in Chapter 105, which is related to parties and how people living in homes when Chapter 90 doesn't apply. And it sets out a structure by which an owner could deal with property that was abandoned in a home without liability if it follows certain steps. And that provides some protections for the tenant who may have had to leave at short notice or without being able to fully get all of his belongings out of the property. It provides the tenant with some notice, some information about how it is and when it is, within a short time period they need to get their stuff and remove it themselves. And it allows the owner to say, okay, the tenant didn't respond within a certain time period, I get to either sell it and keep the proceeds, or I can destroy it if I'd like, if that's more financially sensible. And so that's just one example of a place that we think provides some protection for both parties. And again, we've tried to get feedback from practitioners about how to make that work best. So I think I'll talk enough.
Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Wade.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Wade. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Eugene, also a member of the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor section, and I've been working closely with Sybil and members of her committee on formulating the specifics that will eventually be proposed here. I want to say at the outset, just for clarification, that while I'm here as a representative of the debtor-creditor section of the bar, I can't make specific recommendations to the committee. The Oregon State Bar procedure for adopting recommendations on legislation are a little cumbersome, and we're operating here more as a technical advisors to the committee in formulating proposals, and while we certainly have been very appreciative of that opportunity, I cannot state here today that down the road the bar may or may not take a different position on a particular provision. So that having been said, I don't want to belabor the issue here in the interest of time, but I think I will report that we've made substantial progress in working with the committee and finding practical fixes for problems that have arisen due primarily to the preemption of the federal statute over certain aspects of the Oregon law that was applied before. Plus, just as anecdotally, our office primarily gets involved in these situations as representing the new owner of the property after foreclosure, which is customarily the lending institution. And we have run into innumerable factual situations, which I had never thought would occur in my practice, but they have. And it's good to be able to get some practical input into the formulation of a revision to statute here to address those issues. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. And if there's any pressing questions? No? All right. Thank you so much for all your work. And our next panel, we're going to have Mike Kaplan and Rick Krager from Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thank you so much for being here, for coming back, and telling us an update on the Homeowner Stabilization Program. I know you're up online now, and you have a website, and you probably have some applications coming in. So if you could start by introducing yourselves and giving us an update, please, on where things are with the program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services, and with me to my left is Mike Kaplan, who is our Administrator for the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative. Real quickly, Madam Chair, if I may, and I'm going to turn this over to Michael here shortly to give you an update on where we're at right now, but just as a little bit of background, as you all recall, I first want to thank you for inviting us back. This is our third presentation to you, and we appreciate your interest in this particular initiative. As you recall, back in May, we came before you to let you know that we were in the process of putting together a proposal that $88 million had been awarded to the state. Troubled asset relief program dollars, TARP dollars, had been given to us to allocate across the state to help those in need and help prevent foreclosure. At the time, we were putting together our proposal at a pretty quick pace, and I think actually it was the day of presenting to you or the next day that we were actually delivering that to the U.S. Treasury. So we were successful in putting together a proposal that had five different programs. Came back to you in September and gave you some additional information, announced that four of the five programs that we had put in our proposal had been approved by the U.S. Treasury, so we were very pleased with the progress. Things were a little slower than we had initially anticipated with the approval process, but we were moving along. In addition, we were pleased to announce that the U.S. Treasury had given us additional money specifically for mortgage assistance program, and that brought us to about $137 million in funding that we had. So since that time, just to bring you up to speed, we have been working frantically. Michael here has brought in a really good staff that has just been working night and day to try to get these programs off the ground. I should mention that after our September hearing with you, we were awarded another $83 million of funding. So that's brought us up to a total of $220 million for the state of Oregon, which, again, we're very happy to be able to put into use. I should let you know that we're continuing our negotiation with U.S. Treasury on the fifth program that has not been approved, but we are still working through the details of that.
We'll make sure Senator George finds out about that. He was
very interested in that. But exciting news in that the mortgage assistance program, which was the first one that we anticipated, the first program to get off the ground, has started, and I'm going to let Michael talk a little bit more specifically about that. But before I turn it over to him, I just wanted to just address kind of three of the major challenges that we have faced in this entire initiative. Number one, as I mentioned, is three times now that money has changed. It would have been preferable, I think, on our part that we would have been told that there would have been $220 million from the get-go, and we would have been able to take that money and really thought strategically on how best to use that. As you, I'm sure, know, that with that much dollars, we've had to reevaluate our administrative piece in terms of how we effectively administer that throughout the state. But again, to Mike's credit and his staff's credit, they've worked very well to get the structures in place to administer that, but certainly has been a challenge throughout. I think the second thing we wanted to mention is, you know, our need to develop partnerships with lenders. And we recognize that to make this program work effectively, we're going to have to work with the banks and be able to address each borrower specifically. And it's been a challenge, I think, on the part of the lenders. You have, I think, 19 states now or 18 states that have these hardest-hit fund programs, and they all are looking a little bit differently. So when I was here last time, Mike was actually in Washington, D.C., working with some of the major lenders to come up with a consistent program, particularly around mortgage assistance payment. And I think we've been real successful in, as a collective effort to be able to come up with a program that works. But certainly, working with the banks will be necessary for us and to really develop that partnership going forward to be effective for the homeowners. And then lastly, and I think I've mentioned this several times to you before, is the unprecedented need. I think we've all heard here today on certainly the different needs and the crisis that we face here in Oregon as well as in the nation. And we know that while $220 million is a lot of money, it's not going to solve all the problems that we have here in the state. And we're trying to do our best to come up with programs that can at least effectively solve the problems for those that we're able to serve, which is at this point about 5,000 is what we have targeted. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Mike and let him give you a little bit more specifics about where we're at with mortgage assistance.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Kaplan. I lead the team at Oregon Housing and Community Services that is administering the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative. I'd like to briefly review our first program, Mortgage Payment Assistance, the application process, and some other programmatic details, as well as our vision and goal for the program's long term. This information was emailed to you last week as well, so you'll have it there in your inboxes. The application for mortgage payment assistance is a two-step process. The first step is an online application that we launched on December 10th, last Friday. The application asks homeowners to enter data about themselves, about their current financial status, about their mortgage, their property, and their lender. The application will be online and available until January 14th, 2011. Our priorities are to ensure that we get the resources out to homeowners quickly, while also making sure that homeowners have an opportunity, a significant opportunity and time to apply. Making the application available for more than a month gives homeowners the time to work on it at their own pace. Some of this information may be stuffed in a drawer or waiting a next mortgage payment or a pay stub. We want to make sure that they don't feel rushed to complete it. As of this morning, our website, OregonHomeownerHelp.org, has received more than 35,000 visitors. We currently have 4,400 applications in our queue. Approximately 2,000 of those are completed. The second step of the application process, a homeowner completes after the online portion, in which the applicant will receive an appointment with an intake agency within their county. Intake appointments will begin tomorrow, December 15th. At that appointment, the homeowner will submit documents that confirm the information that they submitted on their application. Submit documents such as tax returns or most recent pay stubs or verification of unemployment. Those documents will be reviewed in person, face-to-face with an intake advisor. The full eligibility criteria will also be confirmed to ensure that the applicant is eligible for our program. This system was designed so that every applicant speaks to a real person. We've responded to some of the criticisms that we've heard about foreclosure prevention programs that currently exist. If a homeowner brings in their full list of documents, they'll leave that appointment knowing whether they're ineligible or eligible for the program. There will be an intake agency office in every county. After the application period ends, we will create 36 separate eligible applicant pools, one for each county. We'll then run a random drawing to select which 5,000 homeowners will participate in the mortgage payment assistance program initially. We currently anticipate 20 to 30,000 applications statewide, though the number ultimately may turn out to be higher. We only have $100 million to fund for this program, and as Rick stated, it sounds like a lot of money. It will, in fact, not support everyone who needs help. After the 5,000 names are selected, we will conduct another review at Oregon Housing and Community Services, a second review of the documents that were submitted to do one more confirmation of eligibility, and then submit the homeowner to the underwriting process. Mortgage payments will be made on behalf of the homeowner directly to the servicer. The payments will last for up to 1 year or $20,000, whichever comes first, as long as the homeowner remains eligible for the program, which we will also confirm on a monthly basis. We'll carefully track every dollar we spend on a homeowner's behalf. We fully expect that as homeowners reemploy or recover from their financial distress, that they will either no longer qualify or will no longer need the mortgage payment assistance, and at that point we'll be able to cycle a new homeowner into the program. So the 5,000 that we'll serve is ultimately a minimum number. We expect to actually help many more homeowners. Homeowners are the foundation of our local economies. Their stability reflects a community's stability. We hope to connect mortgage payment assistance recipients with other available resources in their community. We look forward to working with local communities across the state to help homeowners become reemployed and recover from their financial distress. It's a very brief overview. I'd be happy to take any of your questions at this point.
Thank you. Yes, just one moment, please. I'm going to start by asking if you could explain the 36 separate eligible applicant pools, but a random drawing. Are there 36 random drawings, or how is this going to happen?
There are 36 random drawings. The reason for this is we didn't want the number of applicants in one county would outweigh if we did one random drawing across the state. Wherever the most applicants were would receive the most resources. So this is a way to accommodate for that.
Thank you for the clarification. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I've been Finance and Revenue Chair for too long, but what kind of protections do you have in place to make sure that you stay on top of people who no longer need it, that they don't continue to collect it?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Burdick, we are going to confirm on a monthly basis, which I think is a more effective confirmation than other hardest hit states. We'll be looking at, we'll be comparing first the documents that they submit. In most cases will be continued on receipt of unemployment benefits. We'll also be comparing our list of recipients to the Department of Justice's new hire list to detect anyone who may have received a new job but has not reported to us as such. We'll also be confirming based on if, because our program is a loss of income, as long as they're staying and they demonstrate a 25% loss of income, which is an eligibility criteria, as long as we don't see a jump in their income with the pay stubs that they turn or in or profit loss updates, we'll continue them in the program.
Madam Chair, and can you help me understand how much of a subsidy this is for people? You know, how much assistance they can get on their mortgage, say on a percentage basis?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Burdick, we'll be paying the full mortgage payment. So it can be up to a year of mortgage payments. The average mortgage payment in Oregon is about $1,400 or $20,000, whichever comes first. So if someone has a more expensive mortgage, they may not be able to get that full year of assistance. It may last 8 or 9 or 10 months.
Thank you.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Chair. I was just going to do some of the math, and you kind of helped me out a little bit, but the question I have is, if your agency is getting $200 million and you're helping 5,000, that's $40,000. I'm kind of curious as to what happened to the other 20,000.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Gerard, this is just the first of four programs, so the other three programs, we expect to help another 5,000 homeowners in the state.
Okay, and the second question is, $20,000 a year, that's a pretty nice house for, you know, the interest rate right now is not, it's around 4%, I think. So I'm just kind of curious as to what kind of income brackets are we talking here?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Gerard, we're capping our benefit at people who are within 120% of state median income. So for a family of four, that's roughly $74,000 a year. We feel like the $20,000 is a cap. Most homeowners won't receive that, as again, the mortgage, the average mortgage payment is $1,400 a month, which pencils out to just over $16,800 a year. We believe that the $20,000 cap allows us to accommodate people whose payments have changed throughout the year, or those who did have a house or a mortgage payment that was a little bit more expensive than the average.
Just what is the mean level of the value of the home that's being assisted?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Gerard, we are not capping based on the value of the home. There is a federal requirement that we cannot assist a first lien mortgage that's more than $729,750.
I hope
not. I very seriously doubt we would get an applicant who could afford that home on a state median income.
Mm-hmm. Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think this is a great program. I really thank you for getting it up and running as quickly. I know not as quickly as some people would have liked. And the fact that we've gotten $220 million in assistance, I think, is an acknowledgement of how bad the problem is here. It's not just that they really like Oregon. It's that we have just skyrocketed on the list of states that are way up in having this problem. I just wanted to ask you about the comment you made about verifying eligibility using people's continued receipt of unemployment benefits, because we know that even with federal extensions, we are about to fall off a cliff of people who will lose all eligibility for all unemployment. And I'm wondering how, when that happens to people that are in this program, it will affect their continued eligibility here.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, that's an excellent question. We hope to get people who have exhausted their unemployment benefits. We've worked with the Department of Unemployment to actually target calls to exhaustees to make sure that if they are homeowners, that they are aware of our program. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly an issue that we're going to have to figure out as we continue to verify their eligibility for the program. We think in large measure the access to the new hire list will help in that when they do reemploy, we will certainly know about it shortly thereafter as we have access to that list and can compare our roles to theirs. Again, Oregon's being relatively aggressive in that we're confirming on a monthly basis. Many states are confirming on a quarterly basis. So I think we are going to be as aggressive as we possibly can in terms of making sure that when someone is no longer eligible, we'll be able to move them from our program. The exact documents that we'll require from an exhaustee could certainly be a little bit different than we would from someone who continues on unemployment. We'll be working that out as we go.
Just to follow up, but I guess, so what you're saying is that because somebody's exhausted their benefits does not disqualify them, they will obviously continue to be eligible.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right.
You do not have to be unemployed to be a part of our program.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be able to demonstrate a loss of income of 25% or more.
Well,
so that certainly
those
could
people
be someone who's
would
unemployed.
Be unemployed.
Oh, sure.
They just would no longer be receiving compensation for
right.
it. And my final question is, you know, clearly just by the numbers of people that are going to be eligible, we're only going to be helping a small fraction. I get that maybe the random drawing is the best way, but has any thought been given to helping people who really do have a better chance of being able to pull out of this situation and ultimately stay in these homes? Because, I mean, that's what's so painful about so many programs that are on the chopping block right now is you want to help people who need the help. At the same time, you want to help people who have a chance of succeeding, too. And I don't know whether that's even possible in this context.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, you ask an excellent question that we wrestled with for a very long time. Our issue right now is we're focusing on unemployed or underemployed, and the questions that you need to ask to decide who's likely to reemploy or recover from financial distress are very difficult ones, and given that we're not in a position necessarily to make the best judgment on who that is, we decided that someone who's lost income or is unemployed deserves a chance to keep their home. And at some point, they had the financial resources to purchase a home. You know, we certainly understand that it would be nice if we could look into a crystal ball and identify who would be most likely to stay in their home in 5 or 10 years from now. Unfortunately, those questions turn out to get you in a very murky territory very quickly.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Burke.
And again, I'm not a mathematician, but if you look at it, have you looked at the issue, and this is kind of a little outside your purview, but, you know, if you're paying somebody's whole mortgage, and we do extend unemployment benefits, which we should, is it the fact that you could have a population of people who actually will benefit from financially by delaying getting unemployment even if they can?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Burdick, I'm not delaying getting on unemployment or
in other words, will they be better off financially just staying, running out the unemployment for as long as they possibly can, even if they're able to get back to work? And have you analyze whether there'll be an artificial delay which may make the problem worse?
Senator Bonamici, Chair Burdick, I can't say that there's been an analysis of the likelihood of that happening. It certainly could happen. I think our message and the population that we're going after are homeowners who are struggling to maintain homeownership. Our benefits are certainly temporary. If they're not able to reemploy or recover from their financial distress, then ultimately they will lose their home. In this job market, we fully anticipate that homeowners will be motivated to continue to recover from that financial distress and really won't have an opportunity to delay even if they wanted to. I would say in a more robust job market, there's certainly the possibility. I don't think homeowners, certainly in the counties where we're focusing these resources, don't have that choice at this point. That said, it is certainly a possibility that that could happen. I wouldn't say no.
Senator Girard,
last question. The question I have is, it seems to me like this truly is winning the lottery if you're selected as one of the five, or 5,000. It seems like there's some people that a couple hundred bucks would make a difference if they could have their mortgage. And it seems like it just if I was going to attack this for a solution, I'd look at the ones that, you know, a couple hundred bucks first, 300, 400, whatever, and draw the line at the top echelons where 400 or 500 bucks would make a lot of difference, and you'd be able to get more than 5,000 people keeping their mortgage. Has that thought process entered into the equation? Why did we just decide that we're just going to do 5,000 at 20,000 kind of a freebie for them?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, there is a combination of factors here, one being the major servicers who we negotiated this program with in large measure indicated that they only wanted one full mortgage payment. Now, certain states have decided that they would pay a portion of the mortgage, the homeowner would pay a portion of the mortgage, and both payments would be sent to contractor, I guess, for lack of a better word, who would then combine the payments and then send them directly to the servicer. That sounded administratively expensive and scary to us in some sense. The other factor is that paying partial mortgage payments for people who are unemployed or significantly financially distressed doesn't necessarily get them to the point where they can focus solely on going back to working. Paying out the piecemeal portions of payments would certainly get us to more homeowners. We don't think it would necessarily get us to the point where we're making the significant impact, relieving the stress of searching for a job at some point so that they can focus solely on that. It's certainly a programmatic decision, but we felt like we could have a more substantial impact on homeowners going this route than with smaller payments.
Okay. I agree, but okay.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for all you're doing. I hope the program turns out to be a success, and I know you've put a lot of hard work into it, so I appreciate your bringing this report back to us again. We just have one more item on our agenda, and that is an update on the two work groups on free trial offers and debt collection. The free trial offer bill is LC 980, which was introduced as a committee bill. We have had several meetings. We got down to the point where at the last meeting all we did was change an and to an or an or to an and, so have just about all the issues negotiated. We've had consumer advocates around the table. We've had the Direct Marketing Association, telecommunications companies, and what we ended up with was a bill that requires clear and conspicuous information about the goods and services, the cost, any requirements to reject or accept those goods, a statement if the consumer is obligated to receive more goods based on the accepting the free trial, a right to cancel, and information about how the consumer can cancel and know how to cancel, and then also a requirement that whomever is going to charge the consumer has to get that information directly or get the consumer's consent to give the information to a third party, and that's going to deal with a situation like Karen Garst had with her son who bought the tooth whitener and then got signed up for an athletic magazine. So that bill is a committee bill, and that is, again, the LC 980. The debt collection work group, we've had an equal number of meetings, but there's still some things that are being negotiated, and that group is meeting again on Thursday. So that is, I did not introduce that as committee bill at this time because there's still some work to be done on that issue. So that is the update, and as we close, I want to thank the committee members for your service. I know Senator Burdick and Senator George aren't in the room at the moment, but the configuration of this committee is going to change significantly because I am the only one who's still going to remain on the committee as a committee member with a new name and a new chair, and look forward to taking on other challenges and continuing to work on these issues as a member of what is going to be called the Committee on General Government and Consumer and Small Business Protection, I believe, is the new title. I've enjoyed working with all of you, and we've had a wonderful staff with Cheyenne and Enola, and certainly, and I'm also thanking Senator Burdick for her service on this committee as we wrap things up. And Senator Burdick and Senator Rosenbaum and Senator Girard, thank you very much for serving on the committee, and it's been an enjoyable experience to work with all of you and continue to work on these issues. So,
well, Madam Chair, I just want to say what a delight it has been working with you as a chair. You're just
thank you.
Very strong and fair-minded and very professional. So
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, just let me add my thanks, and also just to say, I mean, not only have you shown incredible leadership, technical expertise, and political courage, but these issues, which it's easy to get just very depressed about because these are the things that are really affecting people out there, our constituents and Oregonians, where they live, are still going to be front and center in another committee,
right.
Definitely. But if we do not find some way of providing the kind of real help that we've been talking about today, going after the fraudulent practices which still are out there, and then helping people find some way of having laws that are more consumer-friendly in a situation that isn't getting better anytime soon, we will really have failed, I think, to do something that Oregonians desperately need. So I have really, really enjoyed serving on this committee and intend to continue having these priorities be my priorities moving forward into 2011.
Thank you. And as I explained, I am still committed to work on these issues and will as a member of the new committee. So thank you very much for your service, and I'm going to adjourn for the day.